Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
I don't know what you think you could do here, Stephen.
John, good to see you.
I see the wife still picks your ties.
What has this kid been telling you?
How far has he gone?
The president's about ready to order a counterstrike. That's what we're recommending you do.
It's a bluff, John. Call it off.
No, it's not a bluff. It's real.
Hello, General Barringer. Stephen Falcon.
Mr. Falcon, you picked a hell of a day for a visit.
General, what you see on these screens up here is a fantasy, a computer-enhanced hallucination. Those blips are not real missiles. They're phantoms.
Jack, there's nothing to indicate a simulation at all. Everything's working perfectly.
But does it make any sense?
Does what make any sense?
That.
Look, I don't have time for a conversation right now.
General, are you prepared to destroy the enemy?
You betcha.
Do you think they know that?
I believe we've made that clear enough.
Then don't. Tell the president to ride out the attack.
Sir, they need a decision.
General, do you really believe that the enemy would attack without provocation, using so many missiles, bombers, and subs, so that we would have no choice but to totally annihilate them?
1 minute and 30 seconds to impact.
General, you are listening to a machine. Do the world a favor and don't act like one.
Yes, Mr. President.
1 minute and 10 seconds.
Sir, at this point in time, we cannot positively confirm the inbounds. We have reason to believe they may not exist. Yes, sir, that's affirmative.
Ten. One. Impact.
Minutes after the hour of one, and this is the month of July, the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along and making it part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, a place from which all goodness derives. Thank you for joining us today. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. If you would like to get on board telephonically speaking, let me just guess it'd help if the phone is actually on. It's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. If you'd like to join us today for your dialing and dancing pleasure, 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com, dawn@rickemerson.com, or the chat box server interactor thing. Interocitor is up at rickemerson.com, the website. Every time I say rickemerson.com, the website, I sound like, I remind myself of Mel Brooks in, you know, Spaceballs, the flamethrower. Anyway, so rick@rickemerson.com is the email address. rickemerson.com has the chat box, and then the phone lines are open at 503-505-6964. Have I been giving that phone number? Okay, there we go. All right, I just had that. Do you ever do this where you forget your own phone number? Like,
oh, yeah.
And a phone number you've had for, you know, like, I've had my cell number for like 10 years.
Yeah, but you don't call yourself very often, so you don't need to actually know it.
Yeah, but you give that number to people like 1,000 times a year. You know, you just say, oh, here's my number, and then you give it. But then somebody will say, well, what's your phone number? And you'll say, well, it's, and then your mouth opens up, and it's just a whole lot of nothing comes out. It's a whole lot of ignorance pours forth. All right, so there you go. So there's that. Coming up today, it is a program jammed, filled, crammed, packed, overflowing with, engorged, tumescent with content. pulsing and throbbing with amusements of all varieties, including but not limited to the top five songs about computers. And we'll get to those later on today. That is because we're going to be joined in the studio by a guy named Dave Howell. And you may not know the name Dave Howell, but you have almost certainly come into contact with some of his products, even tangentially at some point. He was a applications developer at Apple Computer for a long time. Before that, he had his own software company, place called Pablo Software, which made a whole lot of things that were used in Hollywood films for many years. And now he creates Apple applications. And he was on Outlook Portland a couple weeks ago, and I forget, I don't even remember now how it is that we came in contact with him. I think that he may have, actually emailed us, insane as that sounds. I can't really remember how it is he came to be on the show. These things are all kind of a blur in retrospect. But he was just the greatest, coolest guest. And it's not like he had the cure for cancer or something, but he was a guy who really understands the computer industry, and more importantly, was sort of there for a lot of the really crucial periods of it. And then, he worked at Apple Computer and was able to just kind of give me a bird's eye view of what it's like to be in that place, which is fascinating. So we'll talk to Dave Howell later on today. Today's installment of Pop Culture Authority will address the name Cujo, speaking of names. We'll find out from whence the name Cujo derives. And I know that by saying from whence it derives, it's redundant there, the way that I phrased that. But everybody's just going to have to be all right with that. What else? Taser Watch on the way today. Hick Watch coming up as well, and a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, just people are just sending me stuff left and right this week, and I'm not complaining. I'm just saying the audience really seems to be on a tear. We're just passing stuff along to me that I feel like I have to get to. I got so many things that all seem to be fighting for position number one here. Like somebody emailed me this: Rick, please do explain what flavor are barbecue potato chips? They don't taste like barbecue. Which sounds really obvious and dumb, but on the surface of it, when you think about it, and by God, they don't taste like barbecue. Don Taylor?
Well, they do taste a little bit like barbecue sauce, but
they don't taste like any barbecue sauce I've ever had.
They're more sugary and salty than actual barbecue sauce tastes.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. It's like, here's the other thing. Here's what I don't understand about barbecue potato chips. A, they don't sound like any sort of brush-on or marinade that I've ever had in my life, ever. Not once. I mean, even if you just sort of, even allowing for the variances that take place with inside sort of fast food or junk food, they don't taste like. And here's the other thing. I say, not even having finished the first thing. The second thing, which is almost more important, is this. We have the technology. We can make things taste like anything we want to. We can make a potato chip that tasted like a Buick if we wanted.
And there are some really bizarre and yet tasty potato chip flavors.
Please to explain.
Have you had dill pickle flavored potato chips?
I've seen those, but I've never purchased them. Are they good?
They are actually very good.
It doesn't seem like a thing that anybody would want.
Well, it has that whole vinegary kind of thing, and I like the vinegar chips, so it's got that vinegary kind of taste to it. Plus dill, which is, they're actually delicious. I thought they were kind of creepy and horrible myself, and a coworker brought them in someplace I worked once, and I was like, all right, I'll taste the dill pickle chips, and they're delicious.
And they were good.
Oh, yeah.
When I was in Britain, I guess I was in, what's that place that Jane Austen chicks are always going on about? Bath. When I was in Bath, they sold at, there's this store, which I don't know if they have it here in America, but it's called Marks and Spencer. But it's like a Whole Foods kind of place. It's like, we're like a, what would you like? I'd like a small packet of biscuits, please. Well, that'll be 40 pounds,
Yeah, it's kind of like Williams Sonoma, if you've ever been in a Williams Sonoma store.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like everything there's unbelievably expensive, but they sold these like boutique potato chips, which it's funny that no matter where I am, I mean, I can be here or I can be in, I believe, that's another hemisphere, right? Well, whatever. Another continent. And yet the marketing works exactly the same on guys there as it does here. Because they sold me a big bag of potato chips. And the whole reason I bought them, the big selling gimmick was that they tasted like chicken. They tasted like, in fact, like chicken skin. Which sounds gross until you think about like the crispy.
Well, that is the best part.
Really. Yeah. I mean, you get yourself some like a baked chicken or a little bit of fried chicken. You get that crisp skin coating. It was really. And so I bought them. Like, this is going to be the best thing I've ever had. And we went back to our, we were like at this little bed and breakfast place. And of course, we're such trashy Americans. I mean, whatever. A town that has history and stuff and where things have happened. And I'm immediately, let's go back to the room and see what's on television. And so which, by the way, is nothing. I don't think, no matter where you are in Britain, I don't think there's ever a time when anything good is on television. I think that
there has to be, because there are some good shows that come out of Britain, but they're few and far between.
That's the thing, and we distill them all down here and put them on PBS.
We cherry pick them here.
And we just put them in my DVD collection, so I don't need to leave the house. But I think in Britain they don't put as high a premium on the same kind of entertainment that we do here, because I don't know, because they're busy. I don't know, reading or something. What?
Oh, you've offended Mark the Brit. In the text box.
That's hard to believe.
Oh, trust me, American television is 10 times crappier than British TV.
Okay.
Bloody cheek, he says.
I'm not disputing that, but I'm saying we got so much of it.
Yeah.
That even if the ratio of bad to good is the same, even if it's worse, even if there is 99% crap, we make 1,000 television shows a day in this country. They just roll off an assembly line somewhere, right out of Merv Griffin's head. And, maybe not Merv Griffin at this point, but you know what I mean. And so even if it's like a thousandth of the shows are good, that's like 100 shows a month that come out that I feel like I got to watch. In Britain, it was just that Are You Being Served thing, like over and over and over again. that was all I could find. And then like a BBC newscast where it was a lot of, it was a guy like shuffling papers and going, and meanwhile at the House of Lords, fierce debate raged on. I was hoping that I get that one day, a month or whatever, where everybody just gets together and screams at the Prime Minister. Have you ever seen that day?
Oh, yes.
The shouting day or whatever it is, where it's like, what's his name? Like Tony Blair would get up and go, well, look, I have him there. He'll go, no! In the back, and I'm just like, this is awesome.
I wish we had that here.
That we should have brought that over.
I really do.
That is the one thing that we should have brought over from England. Not the one thing. You know what I mean? The one additional thing that we should have brought over. As well as, walls and tea. But the day where just, Obama says, hey, look, what I'm trying to say is, and then we just get to throw stuff at him, We just get to shut it, gang! And just huck something right at him. So, in a peaceful, nonviolent way. So, anyway. I was talking about. Oh, yeah, potato chips. So we can make potato chips taste like anything. Mm-hmm. Have you had, let me ask you, have ye had those Doritos that taste like pizza?
No.
Oh,
no,
man.
I haven't.
Oh, man.
I have always tried to stay away from artificial pizza flavored things because artificial pizza flavoring technology used to be so horrible. It was just something violent that would just give you heartburn and make your mouth ache.
No. Those days have passed. We have entered a new and exciting phase of chip technology. You have no idea how far we've come. You really got to give them a go. Here's the thing. They got the pizza Doritos. Here's the other thing. They have these Doritos. I think these were the ones that came out as the mystery flavor, the X19 Doritos or whatever a couple years ago. Yep. And it was like, they were trying to get people to figure out what they were. And they taste just like a cheeseburger. And it just F's with your head, man.
I find those really, really disturbing, though, because as many chemical additives as there are in just, like, the fake cheese-flavored Doritos and stuff like that, I just keep imagining that it's exponentially more for them to make something taste like something else.
No, see, and I don't think that's true. I think it's exactly the same number of chemicals. I don't think it's more chemicals.
You're probably,
I think,
right, but in my mind, the thing is just grown in a test tube in a lab.
Well, that's probably true. They've also got the, but it just it's like seeing it would be it's like seeing a it would be like seeing a frog bark or moo or something, or seeing a cow, like, it would be like seeing a cow just open its mouth and like violin noises came out. You have this Dorito and you go, oh, it's a Dorito. My God, it's a cheeseburger. Oh, it's a Dorito. It's a cheeseburger. Oh, my mother, my sister. And it's just, whatever. And I didn't even get that right. Is it my daughter or my sister?
It's my daughter, my sister.
Damn it. Damn it. Damn me to hell. Well, you know what I was going for.
I got the reference.
You got the reference. Anyway, so I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But the latest one, though, is so there's this Dorito chip that tastes like a jalapeno popper. And there's a Dorito that tastes like a taco. The new Doritos flavor tastes like a taco. And I swear to God,
we should just have a Doritos tasting one day. Get somebody in here. Maybe I could invite Patrick Allen Coleman from the Mercury. We can have a Doritos tasting.
You say that like it wouldn't, like I wouldn't do it.
I think it'd be awesome. I think it'd be great.
All right, we should do that Friday.
Okay.
What time are Greg and Sarah taping on Friday? 3 p.m.
So
we should ask them to come in early, and we can have a little crossover segment.
That would be very good.
All right, this Friday. Such a rube. This This show is one big Hick Watch. This Friday, Dorito tasting with Sarah and Greg.
Make sure you write that down so we don't forget.
Yeah, no, I'll remember that. All right. What stories have we for the people of Portland today, Don Taylor?
Well, our fine legislators have actually voted, and we've cleared the hurdle for the unemployment benefits extension.
Sweet.
Lesbian teen gets $35,000 settlement over her canceled prom. And Lindsay Lohan is off to jail.
Excellent. It's a good day to be alive. All right. It is 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. A couple bits of business before we proceed here. A, somebody asked me if the mobile stream is up. Here's the deal with that. Let me say this. That we have sent out just a handful of invitations. It's never tried to be exclusionary or whatever. But we just don't want to crash the thing right out of the gate. Because we... Some of you remember the first couple days that this network was actually on the air. It was just we just underestimated. It sounds daft to say that, but we weren't quite sure exactly how many people were going to be trying to get on at once, and we blew all the circuits in the place. So that happened like a couple days right out of the chute. So we don't want to do it with the mobile stream. We have sent out a handful of invitations to people to listen to the mobile stream, check it out, give us their thoughts, let us know if it works, and then we are going to gradually roll that out sort of in stages. So if you have not received an email, it's not like it's in your spam folder, or it's like you're... I made the mistake of mentioning, I think, last week that we were going to do that. So people are like, I haven't received it yet. It's because we haven't sent it, friend. So we're going to hopefully get all of that out here within, you know, a week or so. But right now, we're just trying to build it slowly so we don't just implode everything. Second thing. The hell was the second thing? Oh, second thing. We are going to be putting up... At some point in the very near future, hopefully this week, because, you know, we got the stream running 24 hours a day. So there's a 24/7 stream at rickemerson.com if you're listening to this on podcast form. That stream is now up all day, all night, every day, to the annoyance and joy of everyone. And I got, like, tons and tons of stuff in the archive. There is actually so much stuff in the archive, you think I could just put it all on, but the thing is then everything would only play once because there's so much of it. And if there's popular things or things that people want to hear, performances or interviews or whatever, I don't want to just play it once and then it never gets played again. So we're going to put up some kind of a poll where folks can kind of vote on what stuff goes onto the live stream when we're not on the air here. Because right now what we do is we get done with the show and then Legion of News and the show, you know, they sort of play again back to back in case you missed them. You know, I want to be able to put stuff on the rest of the other 22 hours that people really want to hear. So we're going to put up a little poll about that. So just be thinking on that, if you will. At the news desk, ladies and gentlefolk, it is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Legislation to restore unemployment benefits to millions who have been out of work for more than 6 months broke free of Senate Republican delaying tactics today. Senators voted 60-40 to move ahead on the bill, clearing the way for a final Senate vote later today.
Now, when you said delaying tactics, is that a slice of editorial comment there?
Actually, that... I don't know. That's just... I got this story off of the wires, and it is the facts. They were trying to hold it back. They were trying to delay it.
All right.
The measure would restore jobless checks for 2.5 million people whose benefits started running out 7 weeks ago in a jobless economic recovery. The vote was a modest victory for President Barack Obama and the Democrats, whose more ambitious hopes for a jobs agenda have mostly fizzled in the face of GOP opposition in the Senate. A battle has raged for months over whether jobless benefits should be financed with additional federal debt, as Democrats want, or through cuts to other government programs, as most Republicans insist.
Wait, what was the first option there?
Finance with additional federal debt.
Well, why not? I mean, you know, why not more federal debt?
At this point, it's just kind of hypothetical.
Seriously, I mean, to whom?
It's imaginary money.
And I don't understand the difference between a debt and a deficit, and I'm probably not ever going to understand the difference. I don't mean to be negative about it or to be defeatist, to be giving myself what Tony Robbins would call negative affirmations. But people have tried to explain the difference between debt and deficit to me, and somebody will try to do it right now. And it's probably not going to work just because it seems like one of those things my brain doesn't have a receptor for. It's like how some people can't see green. That being said, I don't mean to seem overly daft about this, but I don't understand where, like, to whom we owe this money. this federal debt. I mean, everybody sort of says China, but it's not like it can all be owed to China, right? Like, it's not like China has IOUs for everything in the place. There must be somebody else to whom we owe money, but I can't think of who it would be. Whatever, did we owe money to Iceland for something? No. So when we say this is a federal debt, other than China, to whom is that debt owed, and why can't we just bomb them?
I have no idea.
See, that's what I'm saying. And you can feel good about that even though you're at the alleged news desk because nobody else knows. You know, there's like one guy, somebody. It's like Alan Greenspan.
Greenspan knows.
And that's it.
Greenspan knows.
But he's not telling anybody.
And he quit.
Yeah. He quit.
He just threw his hands up and said, no, I quit.
I don't know. I don't know from balancing. And he knows, and he's got the answer written down on a piece of paper in a vault. At home, that no one has the code to.
Someone in the text box helpfully types savings bonds, which doesn't clear anything up for me at all.
You can't just put random words up on the screen and just put up, you know, grass taffy, you know, and just do, oh, thank you. By God, that explains it all. I feel ever so much better. All right. Here's Don Taylor. Okay,
the rural juror. A rural school district that canceled its prom rather than allow a lesbian student to attend with her girlfriend has agreed to pay $35,000 to settle a discrimination lawsuit the ACLU filed on her behalf.
Rural in this case meaning?
Tennessee.
Hicks. Yes.
Hicks. The district also agreed to follow a non-discrimination policy as part of the settlement, though it argues such a policy was already in place.
Clearly. You can tell by the way that they canceled the entire prom rather than let a lesbian come with her girlfriend.
And then, I don't know if you followed this story during the most recent unpleasantness, but not only did they cancel the prom, but then they told her and some other gay students and I guess a bunch of other like gimps and losers that they were redoing the prom at this specific place.
A makeup prom.
And meanwhile, the parents of all the popular non-gimpy and gay kids put on the real prom someplace else and didn't tell them where it was.
It was like a bait and switch.
Yeah.
And it is funny is the wrong word for it. It is perhaps amusing and not entirely surprising in a sort of bleak way. That behavior patterns of a-holes in high school don't change once they become a-holes in adult life because, as you said, the long story short is there's this lesbian who wants to go to and that's a Jesse Helms thing, by the way, because when he who was it that he referred to? Who did Jesse Helms refer to as, quote, a damn lesbian? It was somebody who was being confirmed for some sort of a cabinet position. But Jesse Helms, and this is back when Jesse Helms mattered and was alive, he said, in addition to all of like her other sort of ideological differences with him, he said, and she's a damn lesbian, which is how he ended his, which was awesome because so rarely, I miss that guy, so rarely do you get to see just the full hideousness on display from a guy who doesn't care, from a guy who just embraces it and just, you know, what are you? I'm a bigot, you know? And he rolls around in it like a dog in a freshly cut lawn, and it's sort of awesome. Now we just have a bunch of just, you know, it's a bunch of, like, pussy bigotry. Yeah, they won't come out and say it. But anyway, so because the girl is lesbian, she wanted to go to the prom with her girlfriend. And then they said no, and then she fought, and then they said no again, and then they canceled the prom rather than actually let her go to the prom with the girlfriend. Then they said, oh, but we're going to have the school won't have a prom, so we're going to have an unofficial prom for everyone. Except it wasn't for everyone because they created like a fake decoy prom that they sent her and all of the mouth breathers and retainer wearers to and the paste eaters. And meanwhile, as you said, the parents of all the popular kids put on their real prom somewhere else to which the paste eaters and lesbians were not allowed.
Yes.
That whole state needs to be nuked. I mean, like now.
Yeah. The sham prom was attended by only about 10 students, while most of McMillan's classmates partied at a private event elsewhere, a claim that the school denied. But it's like, I'm sorry, how do you, like, hide that?
You don't. You don't.
School officials contend their agreement to follow the non-discrimination policy merely reaffirms inclusiveness rules the district already had. And
they were obviously doing the job.
They said in their settlement offer that they still didn't believe they had violated McMillan's rights. The ACLU, however, contends that if the district really had such an inclusiveness policy all along, it wouldn't have banned same-sex prom dates. It also said the district is the first in, first in Mississippi to implement a policy banning discrimination and harassment on the basis of sexual orientation and gender.
It doesn't matter. It's a slave state. So, yeah. I mean, we all kind of knew that was the case. The thing about it is, it's like when you watch Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, or that's a dated reference. What do you watch now that's like that? The thing is, there really is nothing like Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom now because the shows are so specialized. All we got now is David Attenborough, which is fair enough. Man versus Wild. Yeah. But it's like when you see, when David Attenborough says, "And meanwhile, the kookaburra is in its death throes, realizing the predator has it cornered." I'm mangling the accent because I'm trying to do him and the Man versus Wild guy at the same time.
Is that your accent from the Leverage audition?
Why don't you shut up, huh? Why don't you just shut up?
It sounded European.
You know, your screams of pain when I bludgeon you are going to sound European. Yeah. Say, "Oh, help," as I'm beating you to death with my microphone stand.
I will say. Blimey.
Moving along. Whore. But they'll talk about the animal that's like, it fights the hardest when it's in its death throes. And that's kind of what rednecks in the South are doing. Yeah. And that is, in fact, what the entire anti-gay slice of America is doing. That's why they're getting so pissy about everything. Because, they look around, gay prom, black president, nearly had a woman who might be a lesbian president. And so that's why they're just going so nuts. It's the same reason all the liberals went nuts under Bush, because they just felt like they felt like they were losing ground. It doesn't matter. As Rennie Davis once said, their sickness will be consumed within the next generation or two, and then they'll be gone. But in the meantime, we can all be amused by watching how freaked out they get by lesbians and proms and
well,
so forth.
Well, and Constance McMillan, for her part in it, she got to go to New York City and be Grand Marshal of New York's Gay Pride Parade. And she's 18 now, and she's moved to Memphis, and she's going to be going to college. And she says she's going to use the $35,000 towards her college education.
Awesome.
So thank you, rednecks.
Thank you for paying my way to college, where she's going to have lots of lesbian sex, by the way, more than you can possibly imagine. Lesbian sex like you have never even conceived before. I forget whether she's hot or not. I mean,
she's not unattractive. But
is she a handsome girl?
She's a...
Is she butch looking?
No.
Okay.
No, she's just...
not that it matters.
Your basic average-looking high school girl, really.
Your basic average high school lesbian.
Yeah. You're a basic average high school lesbian.
Let me... Did you... I was going to ask... I was about to phrase it as saying, were there lesbians when you went to school, Don? Which is the wrong, because that makes you sound 100 years old and also like I don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
Well, back in the 40s, when I was in school, we just said that we were close friends.
Really? Is that what you... I have this whole book at home on lesbian nuns, believe it or not, and they call them particular friends, apparently, in the convents. Did you...
We did have a... when we sold my house when I was in kindergarten. And my uncle bought it. He lived in it for a while. Then he sold it. And later, I asked my mother, I was wondering who it was that lived in our old house that I had grown up in. And my mother told me that it was these two school teachers that had retired and were living together.
They were roommates.
They were roommates. And I was like, really? And I remember thinking that was kind of odd, that because I was still quite young, I was in elementary school, that the two grown ladies would live together at a house. And my mother said, well, and my mother just basically explained it. Well, actually, it's like they're married.
They get it on,
but they tell everyone that they're just friends because a lot of people don't appreciate that.
Oh,
a lot of people.
Well, that's how old were you? You said
my mother was very conservative and really bigoted about a lot of things, but she had a lot of gay male friends.
Right.
So I grew up around a lot of gay men, and as a kid, my mother actually I was really small, maybe about 4 or 5, and my mother explained to me that that homosexuals were They're like, you know how men marry women? I say, yeah, well, they're men who marry other men.
And
I was like 4 or 5, and I was like, oh, okay.
See, that's entirely the right way to put it. Because now you've talked about your mom and the crazy and the whatever, but I mean, for what it's worth, that is exactly the right way. Because people are like, well, what am I going to tell my children about this? And you say, exactly what your mom just said. Like, if everybody just did it that way and just explained it like that, everybody go, well, all right then. I did not, Yeah, let's contrast that.
And now that makes my mom sound like really cool, but you should have heard the things she said about Mexicans. It would completely, the things she said about blacks and Mexicans and Asian people just completely like wipes out everything, all of her tolerance for gays.
Let's contrast your mom's take on homosexuality with that of my father. My mom was, I don't want to say she was intolerant, but my mom was. She, as I've described before, she went through this phase of religious zealotry when I was growing up, because my dad was such a jackass that it's that whole thing of like, you know, like the worse everything got with my dad, like the more fervently she would pray and the more fervently religious she would become, because just as the faith healer tells you in the tent, you know, when he lays his hands on you and you still can't walk and you need the crutches, it's your fault because your faith isn't strong enough. It was always my mom's fault that my dad was such a dick, because she wasn't praying hard enough. Mm. And so she would just, you know, become more and more religious. So it wasn't even that she was intolerant. It was just like the book says, you know, you can't do it. So I guess you can't. My dad, on the other hand, your mom's explanation of homosexuality, my dad's response was the first time I remember the gayness being mentioned in my home was when Dan White in San Francisco, that cop that shot Harvey Milk. When the Harvey Milk killing happened in San Francisco, when Dan White did that, and he was, you know, and he had the whole Twinkie defense and the whatever. And I remember my dad drinking a beer, of course, and I believe at one point actually sort of raising the beer in a sort of ad hoc tribute to Dan White, said something like, "They ought to give that guy a medal and more bullets." So there you go. That's home with the Emersons.
And my growing up around gay men was entirely, by the way, with my mother and my grandmother, who had lots of gay male friends. My father, my ex-cop fireman, grew up in Nebraska, father, was deeply uncomfortable around all of my mother's gay friends. So there was never any mixing
here's
of those
thing.
Worlds.
And here's the thing. Here's why. I will guarantee you this. Your dad was uncomfortable, A, because, you know, the guys who are all bent out of shape macho don't like being around gay men because it makes them all, you know, because... Whatever, you know, because it just makes them feel strange and oogie in places where they don't wish to be oogified. And also, as illogical as they know it is, and as paradoxical as their brain knows it is, he was secretly afraid that one of the gay men, if not more, was putting it to your mom, even though they were gay. I will guarantee you that.
I can see that, yeah, because I've heard men express weird things like that.
Yeah, well, because, you know, and you know, not to stereotype, but many times, you know, you in the gay community, there's a premium put on fashion and aesthetic and appearance. And so, you know, if your dad, who maybe is rough around the edges, you know, if there's a bunch of pretty boys hanging around your mom, he's just thinking, I just know late at night, you know, and he's playing in his head the whole, you know, the whole thing. So... I don't even know what I was talking about here, except to say this, and then we'll do one more, and then we'll take a break. Okay. We'll come back with our guest, Dave Howell. You're talking about this girl that tried to have the lesbian girlfriend attend the prom with her. It's weird how quickly times do change, though, because I graduated from school 20 years ago, but even relatively speaking, that's a pretty quick advancement that we got gay marriage in 5 states. And looking back on my high school career, it is astonishing, and this is about me. This isn't about anybody else. This is about me and my small-mindedness and just growing up in a hick town and in a different era, that looking back, there were people I attended school with who were clearly gay. I mean, just gay as a parade. They couldn't be more gay. And yet it was just never, like, it wasn't really discussed or spoken aloud. And I think the reason that I never went, why he's the... It's not like I didn't know, you know, gay folk existed, but I never actually consciously thought about any of my classmates like, well, she's obviously gay, he's gay, because it just never occurred to me, because it was like this... It was this weird sort of theoretical reality that existed elsewhere. And I look back and it's like, you know, some girl with a flat top who's on the field hockey team. Like, I mean, yeah. You know...
I had gay friends in high school because I was a drama geek. But they were all male.
Right.
The lesbians, there obviously had to be some in my high school. But if you had any feelings towards women at all when I was a teenager, you kept it very, very closet. There was no tolerance for that at all.
There was no lesbian chic.
There was no out gay dating at my school among anyone ever. It, you know, I grew up in Southern California, and you'd think that that sounds like it'd be fairly liberal, but no, it's a pretty conservative place.
I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, of my 4 years in high school, I do not believe, and I was like you, I was a drama nerd, and so you know, any number of flamboyant young men in that class, but I don't believe that there was anybody at my school who, to me at least, was out, who was known among the general population to be gay. And I mean, you know, everybody's adolescence sucks and everybody is terrible. But really, however bad my teenage years were, I cannot fathom how. And I'm not saying it's like easy to be a gay teenager now, because it must not be. I mean, you know, you've got a, you know, a country of 45 of the 50 states still say that, you know, that you're less than. But goddamn, I cannot imagine how bad it must have been to have been a gay teenager during the Reagan years. I mean, that must have been the worst thing on earth. It is, when they talk about such a high suicide rate, I'm amazed that anybody who is gay makes it through their teenage years without just tossing a noose over their shower rod one day. I mean, that must be the most unbearable existence imaginable.
Well, considering that just being a straight teenager is so unbearable much of the time.
It's like being lit on fire every day. All right, for the love of God, let's do one more and then we'll take a break here.
Police were called to a single family home in Skokie, Illinois on Monday. On arrival, a 54-year-old woman was screaming for help. She told police that her mother was dead inside. However, the house was so full of trash, firefighters had to cut a hole through the roof to get inside.
Awesome.
They found 79-year-old Marie Davis in the middle of the home. It took them 3 hours to remove her body from the home through the roof. According to one firefighter, there was so much garbage, it left about 2.5 feet of space between the pile and the ceiling.
The funny thing is that she was screaming that her mother was dead when presumably this couldn't have caught anybody that off guard. I mean, clearly mom's not in the best of health if that's the house in which she lives.
Yeah, there was apparently, it was the trash was almost all the way up to the ceiling in every room of the house. There were tunnels. And the residents, the woman and her daughter, had to crawl on top of debris through tunnels to get around inside the house.
Wow.
Neighbors said they had tried to help the woman and her daughter, who is reportedly mentally disabled, but that they were reclusive.
Ah.
The mother would come around occasionally asking for water. I'd take her to food to her door, but she wouldn't answer, one neighbor said. He said he sometimes saw the mother and daughter, always around dusk, adding the mother would collect garbage in the neighborhood and bring it back home.
Okay, that's the creepy line there.
And here's a bit of audio from one of the neighbors.
Do not want. Okay, all right.
But now police have declared it uninhabitable, and the woman's daughter, described by neighbors as mentally disabled, is now staying with friends.
I found out she was eating out of a garbage can, one of the neighbors told me. And my husband said, Pat, let's get her some food. We went in the house, two great big plastic bags loaded with food. Couldn't get in the house, knocked on the windows, and I was afraid, to be honest with you, to walk through her yard.
Jesus, God. That's the going out, and it's the combination of things. It's the going out at night. The going out at night to pick up trash, and then the scuttling back home with it, you know, like you're a magpie that found something especially shiny.
And you can go look up this story. This is from Skokie, Illinois. You can look this up on the internet and look at it. There is some video and some photos on some of the news sites about this. And literally, there's a photograph of the fireman at the front door. And the door is open, and it's like something out of like a sitcom.
Jesus.
It is just solid stuff. You know, all the way up to the front door. And they had to cut a hole in the roof to get in.
And, you know, and the thing, and I've told the story of my grandfather before who had, when he died, it was something like this. My grandfather, he was a nutcase depression guy. He was a hoarder. And so he had the same thing where he had very narrowly defined sort of tunnels and catacombs through his incredibly small prefabricated home in Kennewick. Because every other conceivable inch of space was taken up with stuff he'd hoarded. At the very least, though, at the bare minimum, it was like clean hoarding. In other words, like he would go to the store and he would find what they used to call dry goods, which is like soap or razor blades or even like weird like tampons or something. But like he would find just like staples of whatever variety that were on sale, and he would buy as many as he could. And then he would carefully, on the side of each box with a black marker, write down where he bought them, how much he paid, the date, and then what kind of savings it was over the normal price. And then they would just be stacked in the living room and never used, along with newspapers. That was his other thing. So, but there wasn't ever any garbage or filth. Like
I have a friend like that. He, honestly, a little worried about him, but it's But yeah, he just kind of compulsively buys stuff at Bi-Mart or Costco, and he'll buy like a case of toilet paper.
Is this someone I know?
No.
Okay.
Or 2 cases of toilet paper, or he'll buy like these massive like 50-pound boxes of individual packed cookies and things like that. And if you go to his house, it's like, yeah, his kitchen, there are just stacks of canned goods and foodstuffs and things. And you ask him, why did you buy this? He's like, well, it was a great price. It was on sale. You're going, how many snack crackers do you need?
Can we find an excuse to go to his house? Can we find some other reason to go there and just...
No, I love him too much. I wouldn't want to, like, humiliate him.
No, but I'm just saying, you know, to help him.
It is a little crazy.
Well, it's not a little crazy. It's completely crazy. It's totally crazy. All right. Well, we'll do this. We'll take a break. On the other side, we're going to have Mr. Dave Howell, former application engineer at Apple Computer and now the head of Avatron Software, where science does a thing in a voice like this in the world of something. All right. Just kind of fell apart on me. You stay there. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program right here on the Emerson News Network. Don't go anywhere. We return next.
After school. You know what Elliot's gonna do? Jeff, too. Elliot's at work on a book report using Scripsit on Radio Shack's Color Computer 3. It hooks up to his TV. And Jeff's at his Radio Shack Color Computer 3 playing the newest football game. But wait, what's Elliot doing playing new Super Pitfall? And Jeff's having a blast with a new math tutor. You never know what you might try with more than 100 programs for fun and learning. Radio Shack's Color Computer 3 comes with everything you see here. Other items each sold separately. Only at Radio Shack.
When you're dealing with higher volumes of information and need answers fast, you search everywhere for solutions, but find it hard to get on top of things. That's why IBM created the Personal Computer AT, with the power to push high performance even higher. With the AT, fast becomes faster, and the capacity to handle data becomes greater, all to help put your business on solid ground. The IBM Personal Computer AT for advanced technology.
There's a new personal computer from Commodore with a third more built-in memory than the Apple II at half the cost. The Commodore 64.
The most dangerous man in Silicon Valley sits in an office in this building. People love him and hate him, often at the same time. For 10 years, by sheer force of will, he made the personal computer industry follow his direction. With this guy, we're not talking about someone driven by the profit motive and a desire for an opulent retirement at the age of 40. No, we're talking holy war. We're talking rivers of blood and fields of dead martyrs to the cause of greater computing. We're talking about a guy who sees the personal computer as his tool for changing the world. We're talking about Steve Jobs.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us on this Tuesday. Thank you so much. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964 if you would like to join us. Coming up later on today, we got the top five songs about computers. And I have not even looked at your list. I'm averting my eyes in every way. I'm going to do so until the last possible moment. I want to be surprised. Because here's the thing. I was sort of racking, and we didn't really say yesterday that there was going to be like a no Colton, no Yankovic rule.
But yet I followed that rule.
Because it's understood.
Yeah.
It's implicit. It's one just knows. It's like
I started to include Weird Al's All About the Pentiums, and then I was just like, nah, it's too easy.
It's cheating.
Yeah.
Well, it's like when we did the top five car songs, and I was like, no Beach Boys. No Beach Boys, no Brian Wilson, no Janet Dean. You can't have it. So later on, top five songs about computers, and we'll also have today's installment of Pop Culture Authority. Today we answer the magical question, from where does the name Cujo come? Where's the name Cujo come? That is on the way, as well as a Hick Watch, a Taser Watch. I should mention, by the way, in aid of that and other things, just got too much stuff, got too many things sitting here. The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by many fine folks, including The Cleaning Solution, our latest sponsor, supporter, the latest person who stands shoulder to shoulder with us, providing entertainment to you, the masses, yearning to listen free. Cleaning Solution, you can contact Michael Beatty, the proprietor of that business, at 971-533-3211. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Tuesday.
Criticisms follow Santa Fe's naked bike ride. A bobcat was trapped in a chicken coop. And $30,000 in sex toys were stolen from a woman's van.
Fantastic. More information on all of those as the show progresses. We want to welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show. Dave Howell was first a guest on Outlook Portland, and it was about then 2 weeks ago, something like that. And I'll have to actually figure out how that came to pass, because I cannot now connect the dots in my head to remember how it all came together. But it really ended up just being a fascinating show, and I think we actually came on the air the day after when I was like, I had the best interview yesterday. It was awesome. We have to try to get him on. And just give a little bit of background here. He was the founder of Pablo Media, which was later acquired by Apple, where he was a senior software engineering manager in the applications division. He left in 2008 to found Avatron Software, maker of numerous incredibly successful apps. Mr. Dave Howell, welcome to the Rick Emerson Show, sir.
Thanks, Rick. It's good to be here.
I can't even remember this. This makes me sound a little bit daft, but how is it that you came to be on Outlook Portland? How was that connection made? Do you recall?
I don't know how it happened. Probably some PR hack called you guys.
Excellent. Well, PR hacks are usually responsible for everything. I'm going to do me a favor. I'm going to move this microphone just a little bit closer to you there. That's all me. That's not so much a you problem as it was me positioning it incorrectly in the first place. So we're doing the Outlook Portland. We're talking about your history in the personal computer industry and what you guys are doing now in terms of apps. And I'm sitting there, trying not to think less of the BlackBerry that is nestled in my pocket the entire time, thinking I can't use any of these programs. But I think it was during a break between segments at the end of the show. I said, well, you got to come on the radio show, man. This would be fantastic. We can talk about all this stuff. And you said the greatest thing. You said, well, I don't know. Your audience might end up becoming nothing but nerds if I come on the radio. And Cheryl and I sort of looked at each other with just this. And I was trying to explain, I opened my mouth to tell you that ship had not only sailed, that ship had sailed, crossed the ocean, arrived at port, decomposed and been turned into garden mulch, for the next millennium. I mean, worry not about that, my friend. You just heard that montage of computer commercials we played. There was like the Commodore 64 and the IBM 8AT, which I don't even think I remember. I'm not even sure what that is. What goes through your head when you hear all of those sounds on those commercials?
Well, most of them sounded like it just felt like yesterday. You know, it just took me right back. But the part about Steve Jobs just sounded like today.
Sort of glowering out at you from a magazine covering, I will crush you. What was the first computer you ever used? What was your first experience sitting down at a computer?
When I was in eighth grade, I took a Saturday morning class at the local university and worked on a PDP-11 mini computer. We would program in BASIC. We'd try to steal passwords from the college students and try to play games.
And that was BASIC is actually... BASIC was something that I learned from. There was a magazine called Kids. There used to be a television, but you used to watch shows on television, first of all. And on this television, there were programs with names like 321 Contact. 321 Contact was a science show, which then spun off into a short lived computer magazine called Enter. Enter Magazine, which is one of those things that only I seem to remember. And everybody kind of has their own equivalent, where it's like a breakfast cereal or a cartoon or a movie that no one else seems to have experienced, just you. But Enter Magazine was a computer magazine for children. It was for kids in grade school and, like probably 12 and below. And it was sort of amazing, actually, that it existed in the 80s. And every month they would have a little lesson in how to program in BASIC. And probably to this day, I could do this thing where my whole name fills the screen in some sort of scrolling pattern, which is like a totally useless skill. Unless you are a kid in like 1985, desperately wanting to impress some redhead that is next to you in like the math lab or whatever, what were your thoughts when you were using this computer? I mean, did you have like an instant connection with it?
You know, it was hard for me at first, and just being a kid was part of it. Not really having any formal training, but just kind of being thrown into it, like a kid being tossed in the water, and it just sort of we picked it up bit by bit from watching people and asking each other and experimenting and failing.
Did you, Don, what was your first experience with a computer?
My first experience with a computer was when I was in a gifted children's program. And we had a guy, I lived in Southern California, and a guy from TRW came over and brought us this giant calculating machine that they had that cost like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of dollars, and it could do math for you. And we were like, really?
In only 4 hours, yeah. The answer to this three-digit math problem will be known.
And then my first computer that I actually owned myself was a Mac 64K, which, it always makes me, because that was a big deal, 64K, where you had to actually plug in the external drive so that you didn't have to just keep sticking the floppy in and pulling it back out over and over again.
Yeah, I remember using the VIC-20 as my first computer because it was which I think in retrospect I don't even know where my dad got it. I think he must have gotten enough like some guy that he knew. There must have been somebody like trying to unload them or some friend of his that had upgraded their own kid to a 64 or something. I remember thinking back on it now, the VIC-20 came in this weird sort of, like Commodore 64 is like a deep beige color. It was like a dark sort of taupe. And the VIC-20 was kind of an off-white, but it seemed to me that it was sort of scuffed and like the edges were a little bit roughed up. Maybe as though it had come out of the back of a store somewhere, although I think he must have just gotten it from somebody that was upgrading their kid. And one of the things I was telling Dave about is it was such a rip, though, because you would get the VIC-20, and it didn't even have 20K. It was 16K. And so I don't know whether that was like a thing where they worked backward from the name, and then, Bob, we can only get the 16. And he went, good enough, just sell it. or if they decided that VIC-16 just sounded unbelievably lame or whatever. But it had a tape drive. And even then, it just seemed magical. And you'll hear these, you hear these kids talk about that where they just had no, they had no real direction. Nothing had really connected with them until they sat down at a computer, and then it was like they had just found. It was like the Shel Silverstein book, The Missing Piece and the Big O. It was like where they just found the thing that filled the slot in their head. Was that what it was like for you?
Well. To me, it was just really, it was amazing. The machine could do whatever you wanted it to do instead of it kind of telling you what to do. And it didn't come with instructions, and it was infinitely malleable to your own purposes, and it had possibilities you couldn't imagine. And it was a lot of fun.
Did you say what the first computer you actually owned was?
The one I first owned was a Commodore 64.
And that was actually when that still had like the big ass like floppy drives. Back when floppy disks were actually floppy, before they became smallish and whatnot. Did you create your own stuff right out of the gate, or were you everybody else just like trying to find like a cracked strip poker game from some kid who lived down the street?
Well, in the early days on the university computer, I was just trying to play the games that were already there. So the whole the challenge was to find other people's passwords and get onto the computer. And we would do that by innocently helping somebody to log on and remembering what password they used.
Innocently.
Apparently innocently.
Yeah.
Writing, at the worst, we'd write a program that looked like the login screen and then would prompt people to enter their password and then save it to a file and then actually log them in.
I see. So you were sort of a low-grade Kevin Mitnick even earlier.
No, I never did time.
Never convicted of anything. Strangely enough, the log-on computer at the courtroom, it didn't work. And so you're there, you're using the Commodore 64, and then you're typing away and you're trying to find the passwords. Because that's back when you had to share time, you know, on computer networks. Like, you just didn't have the all-you-can-eat thing. You know, everybody hadn't received a disk from, you know, in the mail, and nobody had a Prodigy account or whatever. When did it occur to you that, like, hold on, I can make money with this somehow. I can create things and sell them to other people.
Well, that was easy. That was when I had to decide on a major in college. You know, music wasn't going to pay the bills, so I had to find a real job. And toward that, I thought, you know, I enjoy computers. I'll try that. And it turned out I was really into it. So it was a fortunate thing. I don't know what would happen if I had chosen biochemistry or something.
We're talking to Dave Howell from Avatron Software. You have told me this before, but I have forgotten. The origination of the name Avatron and where that came from.
So before starting Avatron, I was at Apple, and I was in the Pro Apps group managing an SDK for a third-party effects plugin developers. It was called FX Plug. And I thought I was going to go use that and write plugins for pro film and video production. And just about when I was getting the plans to do that, the iPhone SDK came along, and I shifted gears and went that direction. But until then, I was going to do, you know, audio and video. So the AV stood for audio and video. The Tron kind of stood for the future, and just kind of crammed it together and came up with a word.
And it just sounds awesome. I pulled into the parking lot at the CW to the show, and there's just this car in the parking lot that just says Avatron on the on the license plate. And it was sort of like you were a metallic alien who had been beamed here to do the show for me. You know what I mean? Like you were like Space Ghost or Rom the Space Knight or somebody. And that has just been, you know, has been sort of teleported here to make the appearance. Here's something that I'm endlessly fascinated with, and I will go around the room and ask everybody this. Don Taylor, do you remember your first screen name? And if you say no, you're probably lying, because everyone does.
I'm trying to remember when I was on AOL, my screen name was Java 666.
Java, as it with a V?
Yes.
Okay.
I was working at a coffee place. I was a barista, and that's not true. My original screen name had been Java Girl, and that. Somebody had already taken that when I went on AOL. So, and then it kept saying, how about Java 74932? How about, and I was like, how about Java 666? And then it went, sure, that's available. And I went, oh, okay.
And you're not crap. And then you realize this is an email address I can never use to put on a resume or for a job interview of any kind at all. They're really helpful with wanting to put, can I just make an observation that no one anywhere ever again needs to be putting a dot or an underscore or a dash in their email address or in their web address. I mean, if you just want to take like an absolute A to Z in 0.5 seconds route to making sure that nobody will remember how to get a hold of you, put an underscore in there. The other thing that that like websites will do is if your name is not available, they will like reverse it and put a dot in the middle of it somehow, or as you said, just stick like a passel of numbers on the end.
Yeah.
I think it was like Prodigy that actually didn't. Wasn't it a Prodigy where they wouldn't even let you pick it? It was like just gave you they gave you like pi to the 50th place or something. It was just like this chain of numbers that went on and on and on forever. And like that was your, you know, how can I reach you? I'm 175559332.4 at Prodigy.
Yeah, my first account was on CompuServe, and it was the same way.
Was that okay? Was that the same thing? Yeah. CompuServe, God, we're nerds. This is why you risk nothing by coming here and exposing us to your nerdology, because I think CompuServe became. Did CompuServe become the source, or did the source become CompuServe?
I have no idea.
I think CompuServe then like changed their name to the source, or Prodigy changed it. And then one of them actually just went out of business like a year ago, a year and a half ago. It was like still lingering on. I think it was Prodigy that was just sort of like floating along like some revered spacecraft.
Honest to God, every once in a while I'll still see like a web address or someone on GeoCities, and I'm like, that still exists?
No, no. See, here's the thing about GeoCities. Let me just, we're in my wheelhouse now. Here's the thing about GeoCities. I could go on and on about GeoCities, and I will not, by the way, so just let's have no fear of that. I could go on endlessly about GeoCities and how ahead of its time it really was. Because if you think about the way that the net is laid out now, and it's impossible to talk about these things without sounding like, you know, like an old guy, because no matter how you phrase anything, it is instantly out of date. But how the net is sort of organized into these ultra nichified groups and pages, and even on Facebook, where everything is organized by friend and by interest and by activity and by specific events. And GeoCities was actually, they were really the first online presence to do that, because it was laid out as a virtual, an online representation of an actual geographic community. And then there were, you know, you could be in like Beverly Hills or whatever, like if you were sort of into movies and celebrity, or you could be in Hollywood if you were specifically into movies, and they had these sort of areas that you could belong to. And there was somebody, I think, in Wired last year wrote this article about the final closing of GeoCities, because I think Yahoo actually just turned it off. They just sort of sent like a big email saying like, this is it, like you got 60 days to get your stuff out. And it was just like when they blow up one of those housing projects in Chicago, you know, where the man comes through and says, look, you got 60 days to put everything in your car and get it out of here because we got to dynamite these buildings. So
by the way, we're talking all about this. And yes, someone in the text box pointed out that. And yet when we sign people up to subscribe to our show, they get they're assigned a password that they can't change and they can't pick themselves.
That's because we're keeping it old school here. It's a retro sort of thing that we do. You had founded Pablo Media in 94, and you guys had gone on to great success, so much so that you were acquired by Apple. What is it? What's it like? I mean, and this took place in 98. Is that when Apple acquired you guys?
2002.
I know it's an ongoing process. I mean, it's not like it just, you know, like you just answer the phone one day. But what is it like when you you know, you finally get the envelope or the phone call, or you sign the thing that like, and now you have been acquired by Apple? Is that just, do you just call everybody you know and just, guess what just happened to me? I mean, I would open the phone book and just call random people all day long and tell them that.
Well, you would think so, but first of all, it took a long time. You know, big companies take forever to do anything, so it was ongoing for months, and we weren't allowed to talk about it. And when it finally happened, you know, we were all afraid of mentioning anything because, you know, what if Apple kills us? In the time I was
kills
there,
you with kindness.
As far as we know, Steve Jobs never had anybody put to death. That was just folklore. It was just some fun that we had.
He has people for that.
That's right. Yeah. But yeah, we didn't want to talk about it because we didn't want to get anybody in trouble or, you know, do the wrong thing. So we were just quiet about it. You know, I think on my website to this day, the old Pablo Media website still says something like, you know, our assets have been acquired by Apple. For more information, go to Apple's site.
Please don't talk to me. I can't even acknowledge that they've spoken to us. Because you always hear about how IBM, they were such freaks for secrecy. But I get the sense that Apple is that. And don't get me wrong, I really do admire Apple and Steve Jobs, but they present such a not warm and fuzzy, that's not even the right way to put it, but such a friendly exterior. But they're a very secretive company. I mean, Apple's a very labyrinthine kind of organization, isn't it?
You know, every time that anybody at Apple talks about something to the broad Apple community, I mean the internal Apple community, it gets out. So they have to be really careful about what is disseminated. Everything is secret. If you're working on any new product that hasn't been announced yet, it's a secret project, which means that the person in the cube next to you or the you know, across the aisle from you can't talk about it with you. It's all secret.
So is it understood? Is that just like a thing? Did they tell you that, or is it a thing that it is just known because it's in the culture that, like, you don't say anything about anything to anybody?
No, it's explicit. They have an orientation meeting where they explain, you know, how to be secret, if you're working in a coffee shop, make sure that your screen's not facing anybody else and that kind of thing.
Really? It didn't even occur to me. So it's like you're going to meet Michael Corleone at Patrici's restaurant or whatever that is.
Don't leave the prototype of the phone sitting on the bar.
They didn't mention that. So you're kind of free to do that. That's fine.
Does anybody know what happened to the guy that left the new iPhone just like sitting in the you know, as part of that whole Gizmodo thing?
I can't imagine it would have gone well for him.
Is it? You know, you hear these stories about jobs, you know, emailing people back at 3 a.m. because, you know, it'll be just be some guy in like Schenectady. Dear Steve Jobs, you know, I got a scratch on my phone. What should I do? And he'll email back, buy Apple polish at the store, you know, and he'll just, and it's like he just never sleeps, apparently. Does that happen with employees, too, where you're just, you know, you're sitting there and you're just coding away and then the phone rings and hey, it's Steve Jobs, come to my office. And you're just like, okay.
Not so much, no. I mean, there are people, he would tell somebody else to tell somebody else, you know, go down the line to talk to the actual workers. I got an email from him after leaving Apple. There was a problem on the iTunes store, and our app wasn't listed in the list of top apps. And I sent another email. It had been a month, and it was still missing. And I finally, just on a lark, I CC'd Steve Jobs and Phil Schiller, the senior VP of marketing sales or something. And got back an email from Steve Jobs saying something like, that's just the way it works. When your app goes from free to paid, we reset its count to zero.
It's impressive that he would, I mean, that guy just monitors like everything that goes by. I get the feeling.
And that he knows how everything works.
That's the other thing is he's
considering
not.
Considering how much is going on there.
You know, and that he's not fronting. I mean, it's not like he's a guy who is like some sort of dilettante, you know, that is sort of. I don't know that he's like in the basement cranking out code at his age, but I mean, he knows how stuff works, you know, and it's like he's not just some guy that I think because so much is made of like the, especially in the early days, the Steve Jobs Wozniak split, where like Wozniak is figuring out how he can remove, you know, how many things he can fit on a breadboard or whatever, like, you know, how he can make it smaller and smaller, and Jobs is out there like wheedling $50 billion out of some guy for a computer that doesn't exist. that I think he probably gets underestimated in terms of his technical knowledge.
He doesn't do anything toward the programming end, but he is sort of the designer in chief, not only of the company, but of every product and the stores and the whole experience and the website and everything else. I think anytime you do something there, there's this idea that even if he won't directly see it and comment on it and possibly kill you for making something wrong, one of his people will. Or somebody who reports to him will see it, and you better do it right, or things will be bad.
And by the way, this is just for you old school listeners. This is why this version. Let me back up a second. This is why the as well as we executed it in many ways. This is why the KUFO version of this program was, I think, destined for failure. Because the idea that I could just sit and natter on about Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs and lead up to a Steve Ballmer question, which is coming next, I just don't really know that was going to fit between like Incubus and Slipknot Records. That was just, I think that was a thing that was not fated to go well. I'll have to rein myself in a little bit because I could just gibber on about the computer industry and computer culture like forever and ever and ever and ever. One of the most colorful guys in the computer industry is Steve Ballmer at Microsoft, who is Gates's, one wants to say henchman, and that's probably not the right term to use for a guy that could have me destroyed. But you know, but he is known to be like a real chair thrower and a screamer and sort of a bellower. I don't know if you've ever had any interaction with him or not, but based on what you're working in that industry, I mean, is that true to form? Do you know anybody that has ever sort of witnessed or endured one of those things?
I've known people in Microsoft sales, and he is sort of their salesman in chief. Where Steve Jobs is the designer in chief. Microsoft's driven by sales and deals and business development and negotiation, and he's the master of that. They revere him in sales. They think of him as a force of nature, and it's probably accurate.
When people who are working at Apple talk to people who are working at Microsoft, like if you see each other socially or whatever, is there like some weird, I don't want to say rivalry, but are they different kinds of people? Like if I were to take some guy at Microsoft and his equivalent at Apple, are they different people?
Well, I think there's a lot of overlap. So, you know, there is like a different stereotype for sure. And there's probably a lot of people who wouldn't fit into the other organization at either. But there's an overlap. There's somebody who's more Microsoftian over in Cupertino and vice versa. They're people. But there's definitely the sense that it used to be Microsoft was driven by sales and marketing and Apple was driven by tech. And I think that's completely shifted now. Apple's the master of marketing somehow, and I don't know how quite that happened, but some shift happened.
I can, well, from my, in my experience here, and I again, I have to I can just natter endlessly about almost anything. I mean, even stuff I don't care about. I mean, just the carpet or like celery or whatever. But especially, I'll tell you this. I have always admired Steve Jobs, and I've always admired Apple, but I have never been – this is actually the first Apple computer, this Mac in front of me. This is the first thing I've ever owned from Apple, because I've always just been – you know, it was – I always felt like a little bit out of my price range, and it was just easier. You know, it was it wasn't easier to use, but it was easier just to stick with what I've been doing, which was Windows. And, you know, in offices for a long time, everything was Windows, just because as the saying used to go, nobody's ever going to get fired, you know, for stocking the office with IBM or Microsoft or whatever. But I remember in December of like 2000, well, whenever it was that I finally bought this, December 2008, I was working on this document for the show, and I was typing away, and it was during what we had this thing here called the Snowpocalypse, which is where you couldn't leave the house for like 9 days because it was just locked in. And this, for like the millionth time, Microsoft Word just crashed, and just I lost everything that I had done since the last autosave. And I remember just standing up and just saying, like, F this, I have had enough of this, and I no more. And I that day I called my friend Trevor and I was like, I'm getting a Mac, that's it. I can't deal with this. And it was because Microsoft stuff had bloated to the point where it took forever to do everything, especially stuff that I didn't want it to be doing and that it was trying to do for me. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, Macs are perfect. No computers are perfect. But I think that's where the marketing thing came, is that Apple started taking stuff away and Microsoft kept adding stuff. And consumers have too much stuff to deal with and too many buttons and too many options and preferences, you know, menus and settings. And that was, and I think Jobs and Apple realized that it is about what is not there. It's the iPod. It's like, what? I had one of the first MP3 players that came out from Creative, like in, Jesus, like 1998, maybe? I mean, it was the size of a piano. It was huge. You know, and it held 1 hour and 12 minutes of music, and it was just massive. And, I mean, the thing was like, it had a belt clip, which was hilarious, because, again, it was like carrying a hubcap on your hip, and you just looked like a tool and whatever. You know, and it had like 70 buttons on it. And you say to yourself, this is a thing that is designed by engineers who don't actually know how real people use stuff. And when I saw the iPod, I went, aha, because it was like one button. You know, or whatever, two or something. It was just, and he went, ah, here you go, one button. That's all you need. Bam, done. So I think that's how that shift happened.
So that basically, because you develop apps, and obviously you can't talk about anything that you're actually, you know, creating at the moment. But I was wondering, because there are a gazillion apps now for Apple products and for non-Apple products that go, they run a gamut from the practical to the completely absurd and ridiculous. Is there a direction that app development is headed in now? Of like, what is the next generation of apps? Are we veering more towards a specific kind of practicality, or where is this headed?
Well, the first generation of apps, by necessity, you know, we got the SDK and the notice that the store was going to go live.
That's
in some
software development.
Yeah, software development kit for iPhone developers. We knew that the store was going to go live in just a few months, so we didn't have much time to put apps together, and so it was a scramble to do whatever we could. And for some people, that wasn't a lot. You know, there were people with full-time jobs doing this on the side who were just learning the language and the tools, and maybe they brought their first Mac just for writing an iPhone app. So that a lot of the first apps, the first 800, I think, that came out in the store were put together pretty quickly and didn't have a lot of depth. But now what you're seeing is more complex apps evolving over the last couple of years, and apps that were already fleshed out on the web or on the desktop being ported to the iPhone and the iPad. And the iPad allows even more complexity because of all the screen real estate on it. And, you know, I think that's the main direction you're seeing is deeper apps with more functionality.
Well, I'm sorry.
You are in a perfect place to explain this to the two of us. The iPhone, I get. The iPad, I get. There's a part of me that is curious as to the real world practicality and use for the iPad. You know, who are the people that use this and why? Why do they find it so awesome? I mean, to play with, I've handled one. It's terrific, but I can't imagine myself carrying one around and using it every day. So maybe you could answer that for me.
Well, I think for most people, the computer's main function is to handle email and the web. Maybe a little bit of writing, a page, or at the top. But not for really much productive use, just connectivity. And connectivity wherever they are. So if you're in the car and you stop somewhere, you know, or you're at the airport, you don't want to plug in a whole big computer and try to find a Wi-Fi hotspot. You just want to turn on your iPad, be connected to 3G, and use it.
I will say this, actually. This is I was thinking about this the other day. Stephen Fry, the actor, the comedian, he's also an amazingly gifted writer about technology, which I did not know.
And a huge Apple evangelist.
I had no idea. I was reading Time Magazine. The Time Magazine, a whole piece of Stephen Fry. And you all will know Stephen Fry because he was the television show host in V for Vendetta. And he was also in, I believe he was in all the various seasons of Blackadder.
Yeah. He's Hugh Laurie's comedy partner for
yes.
a long time.
But he wrote this great piece, and he actually really nailed it. He said that computers are for creating content. The iPad is for consuming content. I mean, that's what it is. It's not that you can't, you know, type email or whatever on it, but it's not a thing where you're going to sit and you're going to, you know, you're going to be composing a piece of music. It's not, you're going to write a novel on your iPad.
It's more for, you're saying, more like casual connectivity. It is. Something you carry around to use for reading ebooks, yeah. for just checking in on your email.
I got here's the thing about the iPad. Yeah, exactly. Because I will say that while the first iPad that rolled out is not a thing that I purchased, it is just because I feel like it needs for me. It's like I know that there's a way to connect stuff to it, even though there's no USB or whatever. But it's like for me, it's just too. Who has time? So it's like I'm going to wait. I think for another iteration of it, you know, or two before it becomes a thing that is viable for me. That being said. John Rogers, who's been on the show, who's he's the creator of the show Leverage, and he's also a comic writer. He writes mm-hmm. comics, and he wrote the Transformers movie. Big Hollywood guy, big nerd, big fan of all of stuff. And he got it like right as soon as it came out of the box. He was like iPad, and he had it when he was in Outlook Portland. That was, I think, the week that it had come out, and he had one delivered, I think, to the set, like the day that they were released. He was, bring me your finest iPads and cheeses, and they brought him one. And Cheryl said, ooh, she did what we all did that week. Is that an iPad? Can I look at it? What does it do? And he said, he, of course, the genius of Apple, he couldn't wait to show people, right? And so he takes it and he goes, let me show you the coolest thing ever. And he takes out his iPad, and he had gotten the new issue of Spider-Man. And when I say that he was reading a comic book on it, it does not do justice. I mean, it was unreal. I have for the longest time been one of those like I'm going to read a book on dead trees the way that I'm not going to read it on a Spindle or a Kindle or whatever the hell it is. I thought that way until I saw him reading a comic book on. The iPad, and that's probably the best example he could have used because it's full color and it's beautiful resolution and there's lots of detail. And it was just amazing. And then that was immediately followed up, I think, he showed me one of the things that came like prepackaged on it, which was like a Toy Story 2 book. And it was a book that you could turn the pages just like a regular book, but then within each page, there were all of these objects actionable. They were interactive, where you could like touch a thing on a show. Like there was some, who's the kid? Andy? Is that the kid's name in Toy Story? Where it's like, there's a page of the Toy Story book that takes place in Andy's room, and then in Andy's room there is in the background a bookshelf which itself contains books which can be taken down and opened or whatever. And you're just thinking like, this is blowing my mind. It was unreal. So I think that's the thing. It's going to be like that. It's going to be like the handheld screen in Avatar that Giovanna Ribisi is always picking up, where you just carry it around with you and it just displays the information you need. I think that's the thing with the iPad. My question is, you must get guys 1,000 times a day. As you run Avatron and you create apps and a lot of them are best-selling, you must get guys every 5 minutes going, I got a great idea for an app. Now what it is it simulates a beanbag chair. For all of your other applications, so that you get where I'm going with this. Is there a market for this? I mean, you must be deluged with guys who have app ideas.
We get a lot of people coming along with app ideas, and some of them are really well thought out. And one guy came with a 100-page set of wireframes describing his app, And others just say, you know, my son's got this idea for an app, and I was wondering if you could help him turn it into something.
And what do you, I mean, what do you say if a guy says that? I mean, if you think it's a reasonable idea, if a guy comes up to you and he says, I got an app for whatever, and you say, well, there's something there. I mean, what do you have, where do you, what is the next step for that guy? Where do you tell him to go?
Well, the trouble is that, you know, we all have a lot of great ideas. And the ideas, they're great, and everybody loves the ideas, but they're not the bottleneck in getting new apps out. It's the sitting down and writing and executing that's keeping the apps from...
Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah. And so we're not suffering from a shortage of ideas. So people who come with just an idea will probably have to pay us an hourly rate to turn something into an app.
Which is, if I can ask, what is, and if you don't want to tell me yours, is the industry in a ballpark, an hourly rate for a guy that's
exorbitant. Exorbitant. Awesome.
Good for you.
Yeah. No, it ranges. You know, somebody doing this as a hobby could probably do it for under $100 an hour, but I think most people doing it professionally who have, you know, 5 to 10 or so years experience, or people who, or companies doing this are probably more in the range of $125 to $175 an hour.
Excellent. It really is, you know, it really is a new era in America, isn't it? I mean, it's just, you know, there's that, you know, that the documentary from which I drew the soundbite, that's a guy named Robert X. Cringely, who was he was the editor at PC World for a long time, or one of the columnists there. But that's a documentary called Triumph of the Nerds. And, you know, and that is from 1995, by the way, that soundbite about Steve Jobs. That's before when it was, he was sort of exiled before his return to Apple. It really is just astonishing to think that all of the things that would have got you, you know, kind of exiled from, you know, from social life and house and home and family and whatever, figuratively speaking at least, are all of the things that are indispensable now. So when I asked how much you charged to write an app, and you just said, you know, exorbitant, I mean, by God bless you for it. I mean, it's really, I mean, that's that is the power dynamic has shifted so substantially in the world, not just in America, that it's just it is astonishing what all of those kids who grew up on VIC-20s and Commodore 64s and the Coleco Atom, which is like the most ill-advised computer ever. I remember just, even as a 9-year-old, I remember watching the television, a brand new computer, the Coleco Atom, and just saying to my friends, that's going to fail. No one will buy that. You put it right next to your television. It really is just it's just astonishing. Before I ask you about a couple of the specifics of the apps that you guys have created, which is just a fascinating thing to me, the thing that Stephen Fry, though, said in that timepiece to bring us all back around is he said something that was really, it was perfectly encapsulative of the iPad and of where we are in technology, and it was also it was sort of bittersweet. It was sort of poignant because he was great friends with Douglas Adams. And he, in fact, when we started, I'll just do it now because I'm shameless and also not that creative. When we started at the Outlook Portland interview, with Dave Howell of Avatron Software, who is right here to my immediate right, I started it by using this phrase from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And it's where Douglas Adams is describing what the actual physical Hitchhiker's Guide looks like that Ford Prefect carries. And the phrase is, he also had a device which looked rather like a largish electronic calculator. This had about 100 tiny flat press buttons and a screen about 4 inches square on which any one of a million pages could be summoned at a moment's notice. It looked insanely complicated, and this was one of the reasons why the snug plastic cover it fitted into had the words, "Don't Panic," printed on it in large, friendly letters. It's a sort of electronic book, he said. It tells you everything you need to know about anything. That's its job. When that's 31 years ago. And so Stephen Fry said, you know, it's just such a sweet, sad thing. He said that it is his biggest regret that Douglas Adams did not live to see the iPad. He said, because that is the closest that society has yet come to creating an actual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
And Douglas Adams was a big fan of Apple. He was a Mac user. He was the keynote speaker 1 year when I went to Macworld. And seeing him speak was just delightful.
You never told
me
about the Mac world. You can't hold out on me like that.
You don't know everything about me.
Well, I'll find out. So it's just bringing this all towards, I don't know, some sort of resolution. So at Avatron, you guys make apps for, the iPad and the iPhone and et cetera, et cetera. Is it just Apple stuff that you guys do?
So far, yeah. I mean, we're really focused on the iOS platform, but... you know, there's a lot of predictions that Android's going to succeed somewhere. So we're going to be ready for it, and we're going to port one of our apps to Android and see how it goes.
My mom is 74, and she just bought a Droid. So, I mean, that's
That's my next phone.
Yeah, there's something there. Our executive producer, Bruce Agler, when I was talking about the Avatron, just, said, oh, I'm going to have this guy in Outlook Portland. And I was describing this app you guys have that so it's like your wireless device can basically become a separate monitor for your computer. Like if your monitor's too big and cumbersome or you want to carry it with you, it's just like your monitor can then suddenly appear on your handheld, right? And Bruce, that's the best thing I've ever heard. Where can I buy that? And I was just, that's a genius. Why didn't I come up with that idea? And I was, I don't know, man. So, is that the thing where you just wake up in the middle of the night and you go, Eureka, Zoot Allures, and you just write it down and then you go to work and you just tell a guy, like, make this now.
Actually, there was one of the guys at work, Dean Beeler, one of our engineers, who just came up with that idea. And it took a little while for the idea to grow on me, not because I didn't think it would be useful. I thought it would be great. It's just it sounded too hard. And he started describing how he would implement it, and it kind of grew on me. I realized, yeah, we actually could do that. That's possible. So, and it really didn't take as long as I had thought it would to turn into an app. And it's pretty solid right now. We have big plans for it going forward.
What's the other big seller you guys have had?
The other one's Air Sharing, which is a family of apps that it starts out. Its functionality is a little hard to describe as succinctly as you described Air Display. But Air Sharing works like a wireless hard drive. So your iPhone or iPad lets your computer mount it as a drive on the desktop. And you can drag files onto your iPhone or iPad over on your computer desktop, and then you can take those files away with you and view them on your device.
That's fantastic.
Do you have any particular apps that you personally find just completely delightful?
I like some of the games.
Lightsaber. That's the lightsaber. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I like some of the games that were designed just for the platform. There are other games that have been ported from some other platform, and they don't usually wow me as much. But
it's all about, what is it with that bejeweled, bedazzled game, whatever the hell that is? You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I know. It doesn't do
everywhere
much
I go, it doesn't matter. It's like everything I open, it's like I open the refrigerator at home, and it suddenly has got a bejeweled app or whatever the hell it is running in the back by the crisper. It's just, it's omnipresent. What is the most useless app that you have seen recently?
Oh, boy. You know, all of those novelty apps that just make a single sound certainly would fall into that.
Oh, God. Can I just tell you this? I'm sorry. I don't mean for you to trigger a whole thing. But there is a how do I put this? There is a broadcasting company here in Portland of which many listeners are not fond for any number of reasons. And when our show had gone off the air at KUFO, once I got the let go over there, they had a series of meetings with me because they wanted me to bring my patented wit and charm to the Intertron via their company. They wanted me to basically do this there, but probably in a less interesting form for 12 minutes at a time. And I had a series of meetings with the ostensible head of programming at this large broadcasting concern, and I swear to God, probably 15 times over the course of an hour meeting with him, he would interrupt the meeting by playing fart noises off his iPhone and then holding it up so everybody could see, like, that came off my iPhone. And I would just think to myself, God, you're a child. I am never coming to work here. I don't care how much money you offer me. I will never. That may, in fact, be the reason that I never took any of their offers and why, I just said, I'm doing this on my own. I can't work for you. I mean,
I have a friend with an iPhone, and he we were playing a board game. And he insisted on using his iPhone with the rolling dice app, where you shake the iPhone and it makes the rattly dice.
Well, that's
kind
of great, actually.
Except that we had actual dice. He was the only one using that because he could. So it'd get to be his turn, and he'd take his phone, and he was driving me crazy.
Fantastic. Excellent. I guess a final question, maybe, and we'll have to have you back again sometime. I really could just natter on and gibber endlessly just until the cows come home and are fed and fattened and slaughtered and turned into hide somewhere. People have been, for a long time they talked about the imminent death of Apple. People sort of predicted, the death of Apple, back in 95 mm-hmm. when that documentary came out. Cringely just said, they're now a company in decline because it seemed like they were, they had like 5% market share or something and shrinking. But now people are sort of doing that with Microsoft. There's, and Larry Ellison is very fond of, at Oracle is very fond of it, saying that, their time has come because you're not going to go to the store and buy crap in a box anymore. It's all going to reside online. And he's like, they got to that game too late. In like 10 years, what do you think the relative power positions of like Apple and Microsoft and whoever, Google, whoever else, what's that going to look like, do you think?
It's an interesting question, because you look back when people were saying IBM was dying. They didn't. They found what their core strengths were as they sort of shed everything else. They focused on that, and they really became a powerhouse in kind of mainframes and services and those things, that whatever it is that IBM does now. And Microsoft could do the same kind of thing. You know, if their strength is in negotiations and sales, you know, maybe they'll be a software store. Maybe they'll – I don't know. But I think they'll have to start shedding things that aren't their core competency at some point.
And what is – and what – I mean, this sounds like I'm opening myself up to endless punchlines, but what is Microsoft's core – their core competency when you say that? What is it? What is it they? What does Microsoft do better than anybody else?
The only thing I can think of is Office software. I mean, they really do. Excel is awesome. It's cumbersome and it's got kludges, but it does everything you want it to do.
All right.
And Microsoft Windows, maybe not so much.
Microsoft Windows, no, it does everything you want it to do. It just does like 9,000 other things that I don't ever want it to do. Again, I never need to... It looks like you're making a document. Can I ruin it with useless additions? Thank you. All right. Don Taylor, final question, observation, thought?
No, I'm good.
All right. Well, there you go.
I got nothing.
As Eddie Izzard would say, ending on sort of a note. All right. Avatron Software is the name of the company, and your apps can be found everywhere, on everything that ended, you know, that starts with an I.
Just search for Avatron in the App Store.
Excellent. Fantastic. We will have to have you back. Thank you for spending some time with us. We have today's top five, the top five songs about computers, and we'll go to the news desk with Don Taylor. Hick Watch, Taser Watch, all that on the way. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program right here on the Emerson News Network. Stay right there. Back after this.
I'm a champion of D&D. MC Escher, that's my favorite MC. Keep your 40 out, just have an Earl Grey tea. My rims never spin. To the contrary, you'll find that they're quite stationary. All of my action figures are cherry. Stephen Hawking's in my library. My MySpace page is all totally pimped out. Got people begging for my top 8 spaces. Yo, I know pie to 1,000 places. Ain't got no grills, but I still wear braces. I order all of my sandwiches with mayonnaise. I'm a whiz, a minesweeper, I can play for days. Once you see my sweet moves, you're gonna stay amazed. My fingers moving so fast, I'll set the place ablaze. There's no killer app I haven't run. At Pascal, well, I'm number one. Do vector calculus just for fun. I ain't got a gap, but I got a soldering gun. Happy Days is my favorite theme song. I could sure kick your butt in a game of ping pong. I'll ace any trivia quiz you bring on. I'm fluent in JavaScript as well as Klingon. Here's the part I sing on.
You see me roll on my Segway. I know in my heart they think I'm wide and nerdy.
Think I'm just too wide and nerdy. Think I'm just too wide and nerdy. Can't you see I'm wide and nerdy? Look at me, I'm wide and nerdy.
I like to roll with the gangsters. Although it's apparent I'm too wide and
too wide and nerdy.
So wide and nerdy.
I've been browsing, inspecting X-Men comics. You know I collect them. The pens in my pocket, I must protect them. My ergonomic keyboard never leaves me bored. Shopping online for deals on some writable media. I edit Wikipedia. I memorize Holy Grail really well. I can recite it right now. And have you ROTFLOL. I got a business doing websites. Well, my friends need some code. Who do they call? I do HTML for them all. Even made a homepage for my doll. Yo, I got myself a fanny pack. They were having a sale down at the Gap. In my nights with a roll of bubble wrap. Pop, pop, hope no one sees me. Getting freaky.
I'm nerdy in the extreme. Wider than sour cream.
I was in AV club and glee club and even the chess team. Only question I ever thought was hard. What do I like, Kirk, or do I like Picard?
Spend every weekend at the Renaissance Fair. Got my name on my underwear. They see me strolling, they laughing, and rolling their eyes because I'm so wide and nerdy.
Just because I'm wide and nerdy.
Just because I'm wide and nerdy.
All because I'm wide and nerdy.
Holy cow, I'm wide and nerdy. I wanna bowl with the gangsters. I'm wide and nerdy.
Think I'm just too wide and nerdy.
Think I'm just too wide and nerdy.
I'm just too wide and nerdy.
Look at me, I'm wide and nerdy.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us.
I take it we're doing one of these extra long super bonus give them more for their money shows today.
Well, you know, Greg and Sarah already taped Fun Employment for today. So there's no one to make me leave.
No, I don't have to be anywhere.
Well, this is, I was going to say, this is like one of those shows that you would see Springsteen do back in the 70s where he clearly had nowhere else to be. And he's like, we're going to play for 5.5 hours, you know, and... You know, people are just sort of exhausted and laying on the floor. Boss, we've had too much. No more rock. You know, there's never enough rock. And then, you know, he'd play Ramrod for the 70th time. All right. All right, now that he's out of the room, how cool is that guy? Come on.
That was very cool.
I mean, yeah, I could, as I think you might have noticed, I could just talk about that stuff all day. Because as little tech knowledge as I really have compared to, you know, like a, you know, a Seamus or a Thomas or Bruce, I mean, is it... I am just so fascinated by the culture of and the evolution of computers and where that whole industry and their effect on society has been and where it's gone to. I mean, you know that, like, War Games, which is the clip we started today's show with.
Yes.
You look at War Games, and I mean, it's sort of like picking on a it's like picking on a handicapped kid to say, like, well, it's so dated, because of course it's dated, but I mean,
yeah,
it is dated like in an exponential way. Which is really a testament to how quickly things evolve. All right. Anyway, so there you go. How are you, Don?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm happy.
Are you happy?
I'm having a good time, yes.
All right, fantastic. And so forth. Well, let's do this. We'll do some news. We've got the Taser Watch on the way, Hick Watch on the way. I go to this Pop Culture Authority. That's all coming up as well. In the meantime, in between time, ladies and gentlefolk.
And now... From the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Complaints flooded into Santa Fe's City Hall after last month's World Naked Bike Ride. The City Council is now looking to place some ordinances that will force people to cover up a little bit more. The World Naked Bike Ride was organized to promote bicycle awareness and protest the world's dependency on oil.
It was not. That's a lie. That's a lie. That's a lie. That's not true. It's just attention-whoring hippies. That's what it always is.
But after nude riders raced around the Santa Fe, New Mexico's plaza, people complained that children were present. And I have a little audio here from, what is his name?
Please tell me it's a child who is traumatized.
No, it's Mayor David Koss, the mayor of Santa Fe.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
But Mayor David Koss and several council members say lots of people complained.
It does offend some people, but two, you're kind of like forcing children to see it.
Right now, Santa Fe's nudity laws say...
You just have to cover the primary genitalia.
But at the end of this month, the council will discuss some modesty modifications. A proposed ordinance would force people to not only cover their genitalia, but portions of their buttocks and breast area.
I have a weird inflection to my voice. Everything is nasal.
But now police have...
And accented at the end. And I put all the stress on the last syllable in the words. Jesus, God. And that guy, who's the
that's the mayor.
Like tedium incarnate.
It offends some people.
He's like the Spatula City guy. The I like Spatula City so much I bought the company.
Yeah, my favorite quote, it does offend some people. Second of all, you're kind of forcing children to see it.
Look at my penis!
Yeah.
All right.
The proposed ordinance does say that it will not restrict nudity being used to communicate ideas and other forms of expression.
It's usually an idea that it's time to go home and give yourself a good grooming or maybe bathe. Or, you know, the idea that you might want to hit the gym every now and again. That's the idea that I get. Or the idea that, ooh, I'm going to look somewhere else. Jesus, God almighty. Children and so forth. There was somewhere else I was going to go with that, but I can't remember what it was. Hey, did I tell you that I've got yet more sound from I've got more sound from this guy. Where is that soundbite that I put over here? It's the guy who was talking about teachers and when are teachers going to learn not to have sex with their children?
Oh no, you didn't.
I have to I have all of these sound banks over here. It's a little bit behind behind the scenes stuff where I now have. I have a sound bank that is just sort of instant access to any number of sound effects. So I can just, let's see, or this.
He put the little round object in his mouth. It was delicious.
It's true. So I've So I've got that over here. That's what I use technology for, by the way. I wish Dave Howell was still here to hear me do that. So I could just edit
it. Yes, that would have impressed him.
This is what I use your science for, Mr. Computer Guy. But now I've started now to archive some of the sound that we've had in the last couple of weeks, including this guy.
When will teachers finally understand it's not okay to have sex with our students?
And who can forget this one?
If he's still alive, what would be their working theory? Did she sell him?
So, I finally got that entire story that we teased, maybe a couple of weeks ago. We actually never really got to it. We can play one of these. It's not going to get dated. That story where Kira Phillips was talking about how the new trend among teenagers is to bite one another.
Oh, yeah.
So I have some sound, but I will edit this down for tomorrow. I have some new sound from this guy.
When will teachers finally understand it's not okay to have sex with our students?
The answer is apparently never, by the way. No. That's a lesson that's not going to be learned by anybody. So forth. All right. Well, in any event, let's plunge on ahead, shall we?
Well, let's do this taser watch then.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, here is your taser watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Don't taste me, bro.
You know, listening to that taser watch, which is, by the way, brought to you by mugshotlist.com, run by a good friend and listener of ours, a guy named Andy. Mugshotlist.com covers 19 counties in Oregon and 13 states, including Florida, Georgia, Texas, Ohio. And I swear to God, he said this in an email last night. I'm not making this up. He actually said that there is, quote, an army of robots that is constantly updating the site. So I don't know whether these are robots he's constructed himself, or if it's if it's something Avatron made for him. I don't know. But so the point is, if somebody gets arrested and booked, they're on the site like almost immediately. So there are robots updating the site all the time. Please do check it out. And as apparently the lawyers require that we put it, everyone is innocent until they're proven guilty. You know what I'm saying there? Taser watch brought to you by mugshotlist.com. Here's Don Taylor.
A British man is threatening to sue police after an officer accidentally discharged a 50,000-volt taser into his groin. Peter Cox, 49, was on his
Peter
way to...
Peter what?
Peter Cox.
Peter what?
Peter Cox.
No. Peter what?
Cox.
Thank you. All right.
Was on his way to do some landscaping work at the home of a friend when he noticed a police patrol car was following him.
Wait, is his first name Peter?
Yes.
I missed that all
his
in the
name
whole...
is Peter Cox.
In the flurry of Cox, I missed the Peter.
He pulled over to outside a friend's house in Bridgewater, Somerset, but after a short conversation with police officers, collapsed to the ground after being shot in the groin. Police today confirmed the taser weapon was accidentally discharged and an investigation was underway. Eyewitnesses to the incident say that the male officer pointing the taser gun at Peter Cox for more than 20 seconds before lowering the weapon, but the weapon discharged accidentally and Peter dropped to the ground in agony after one electric probe missed his genitals by 3 inches. Mr. Cox said, I got out of the car and asked the police what they wanted. I then asked them to park on the other side of the road because we were working on the front garden. The officer didn't say anything, but he got out of his car and pulled out a taser and pointed it at me. I didn't know this at the time, so I just went on with what I was doing and got a bag of stone for the garden out of the boot. Then he shot me. So, yes, paramedics treated Peter, who suffers from debilitated Guillain-Barré syndrome.
What is that? That sounds bad. I mean,
that's like the chronic fatigue syndrome.
I don't know. No, you're thinking of Epstein-Barr. Epstein-Barr.
Oh, you're right.
Like
I am thinking
fatigue.
Of Epstein-Barr. This is Guillain-Barré.
I don't want any disease that's hyphenated, by the way. Nothing that's hyphenated is any good. So I got many questions here. First of all, it missed his groin by 3 inches. So one of them hit his groin.
No, it missed his genitals by 3 inches. It was in his groin area.
Oh, I see. So it did. Okay, so it hit him
like
in
the crotch area. The
okay, so like in
region.
The crotchal region. Yes,
yes.
I was just going to say that. So the in that general vicinity,
right?
Not in the sort of business though, but you know, close enough.
Close enough.
Well, and plus,
and it's a taser, so
and it's electricity,
know.
Which goes everywhere instantly.
Right.
So it doesn't really. At that point, it's a game of inches. I mean, it doesn't really.
Really.
It is like horseshoes. There, it's close counts. I think.
Yes, he was hit in the groin and his right ankle.
How does that happen?
Well, it's the kind with the wires that shoots out. So one probe.
But they don't shoot in opposite directions. They're not stealth.
Well, they fly out. They can, and if they, and if the guy was actually, it sounded, what it sounded like is the cop pointed the taser at him and was lowering it, and he accidentally hit the trigger, and so one sort of went forward and one kind of arced down.
See, that's, but that does that. No, I call shenanigans on that right now, because that's one of those laws of motion things where, if they both shoot out of the gun going straight forward, bullets don't just veer off in random directions. They go straight. So these are basically projectiles. So the guy had to have been in a fetal position or curled up. That's the only way you could hit him in the ankle and the groin with the same pair of tasers.
I don't believe that. Not if it's the kind with the wire, because it would fly.
Yeah, but they're going to fly in a straight line unless acted on by an outside force. That's the thing. They're not. They're going to go straight forward. They don't just. It's not like a can of novelty snakes where you, hey, look at this, you know, and it's like the tasers just come out in every which direction.
You're right, Rick. This entire story is just a tissue of lies. They're just making stuff up.
No, I'm not saying they're making stuff up, but if he were, like, huddled up or curled up or something, would that not account for hitting them in two places at once that are far apart?
Also, I'm just saying if you know, like somebody in the text box, acted on by an outside force, like the wires, but yeah, if you're pointing something down, if it's kind of pointing sort of down, one might very well have hit him in the groin. The other one kept going and went to where his ankle
okay,
is.
Okay, hold on a second. I'm going to stand. Let me just turn on the guest mic.
This isn't going to involve me touching your groin, is it? Because we talked about this yesterday.
If I had a nickel for every time. All right, so I'm standing here.
And let's say I am that's your height or slightly taller.
That's 3 feet apart. There's no way, if the taser is like this.
If you were, well, let's say, what if you were turning away slightly? One could hit you in the groin, and one could keep going that way.
But you understand you're talking about a thing that is basically the size of like a walkie-talkie. So the tasers are like 2 inches apart.
Right, and they're on wires, and they fly. They project.
This is one of those times I really wish somebody would get on the text box and just correct you, because it's always me that needs correcting. Now that the worm has
turned. What
does
that tell you? Rick Emerson, what does that tell you?
It's like Lucas Jackson would say, where are you now? That's fine. Fine, I know that I'm right. In my heart, I know that I am right about this. All right, whatever. Doesn't matter. What matters is this Taser Watch is brought to you by mugshotlist.com. Mugshotlist.com, updated around the clock by an army of robots. Fantastic. Do you have the Sarah Palin sound? Because I do, if you don't.
I do not.
Oh, man, this is the best thing. Somebody sent this to me last night. This is listener Jason. God bless you, Jason. Listener, can I just take a moment to say what a fine program you get for your 32 cents a day? I mean, just think of just today. Just think of today's show and how glorious it's been. 32 cents, you know, over the Dave Howell guy, Taser Watch. You saying cocks like 100 times. I mean, it's just been your Weird Al that we played a bit earlier. Your Alice Cooper singing West Side Story.
We still have a top five coming
top
up.
Five, pop culture. It's just, you know.
This is a jam-packed show.
32 cents this cost. This is somebody calling to say that I'm right about the taser thing. You know it's true. All right. I hope the phone is turned on correctly. Let's just take a look at day one, shall we? Hello, hi, Rick Emerson, radio program, sir, or madam, is the case maybe? How can I help you?
Hey, Rick. As much as I actually don't hate it as much as I was going to indicate, I have to correct you about the taser.
Is this Andy?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Correct away.
You're right, that could be because the guy was curled up.
Yes.
But there's also, it could be that maybe one, from the angle, I don't know what angle he was tased at, but one could have hit the groin and then another wire would have continued going down and hit the ankle.
Well, I know, that's what Don was saying, but my point is that if they're both, the taser is essentially the width of a size of a pack of cigarettes, let's say, that means the taser prongs themselves are maybe 3 inches apart, being generous. If they are projectiles, in other words, things shot straight out of the barrel of the taser, they are going to go in a straight line. And also, if they are strong enough to go through your clothing and lodge in your skin, they're shot with enough force that just like a breeze isn't going to blow them off course or the weight of its own spring. They're going to go straight forward. There is no way that one of them is just going to angle off at some bizarre angle.
Well, maybe the guy holding the taser didn't have the most steady hand.
But they launch at the same time from the same place. If he had been jerking the taser down with one hand, in other words, they both would have gone that way because they shoot out at the same time from barrels next to one another. There is no conceivable scenario in which you would shoot them out of the taser and one would just decide to take a left turn at Albuquerque, like for reasons unknown. That would never happen.
Well, assuming the taser was in perfect working order, yes.
Well, that it wasn't like an Acme novelty taser to amuse your friends?
Well, or that maybe there was a nick in the barrel or something.
I see. Who's?
I'm not saying...
Who's stretching for implausibilities now? I see. This is.
I'm saying there's possibilities. Scientific method and all that.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you.
All right, you bastards. Fine.
This ended worse than I intended.
Yes, I was going to ask you how you felt about the outcome of this phone call.
I'd put it on maybe a 2 on a scale of 1 to 5.
Well done. All right. Thank you, sir.
Bye.
All right, that's Andy.
There was Andy.
Yeah, okay. Here's Don Taylor.
A donkey was forced to parasail over a beach in Russia for half an hour as part of a misguided marketing stunt designed to attract vacationers to a private beach. Beachgoers were horrified to see the animal hoisted high into the air, into the sky, screaming in fear as it flew over a beach in the Cossack village of Golubiskaya last week.
Which sounds like a really, really great place, maybe for a second honeymoon.
The donkey screamed and children cried, said a police spokesperson. No one had the brains to call police. On landing, the donkey was dragged several meters along the water before being pulled out half alive.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to laugh at the poor donkey. But, I mean, the donkey screamed and children cried, and then it was dragged several yards along the water.
A spokesperson for an animal welfare charity said, this animal would have been extremely distressed, suffering immeasurable fear and pain. This should never have happened.
Do you think?
Employees of the vacation firm in this village could face 2 years in prison if they are charged and convicted of animal cruelty.
God damn, that's fantastic. That is like the worst marketing idea I've heard in quite some time. That's one of those the throwing turkeys out of a plane on Thanksgiving style ideas.
Unfortunately, the printer was acting up this morning. There was actually a blurry photograph of the donkey attached to a parasail.
Oh, man. You know what I should have asked Dave Howell from Avatron Software when he was here? Should have asked him to explain this whole business of the ink and the printer because, you know, he knows stuff. And I don't want to blame that woman at Office Depot because she did have a little flip card thing in front of her that said, you know, what? It was my fault, actually, because I think I said we had a 6700 series and we have a 6900 series. So that's me, Rick Emerson. I am responsible for the fact that there's no ink in the printer today. But goddamn.
Fortunately, after you've opened them, though, you can still take them back to the store.
Is that true?
Yeah. You could say, you guys sold me the wrong one.
Because I kept the receipt and everything.
Yeah. So you can exchange it for the right
one. That's fantastic. Because it's $31 I had to pay for that. I mean, I know that I'm like the billionth guy to complain about the cost of ink, but F me. Come on. I mean, that ain't right. All right. Well, in any event, hey, I got this Sarah Palin sound that we're going to get to here in just a second because listener Jason sent it to me. So we'll do that here in just a skosh. Before we do that, though, I want to take a moment to talk about yet another one of our many fine partners and compatriots in Whimsy, one of our fellow travelers on the road of amusement. His name is Michael Beatty, and he runs a company called The Cleaning Solution. Now, when I say a company, it's not like some international oligarchy or whatever. He owns it. It's locally owned and operated. And see, when they say locally owned and operated, usually that's just a lie. Most companies that say that, it means it's like a locally owned and operated, like, franchise of Megacorp, you know, Limited or something. Not so. There's a guy, he actually started the business. I think some years ago, he said he started it in his garage. and now it just runs it as, you know, as an actual regular company right here in Portland. And he's been a listener of the show for a long time, and he's our latest proud sponsor. And what they'll do is the cleaning solution, as you might extrapolate from the name, will come and they will provide an answer to some sort of a stain or a mark or like a scuff, anything that gets in your carpet. Because the thing about the carpet
pizza?
Is...
Grounded pizza?
Grounded pizza, yes.
Oatmeal?
Oatmeal, sure.
Mud?
What kind of place do you live in? You live in a primate house? Yes. Quick lime? Bone meal? What about lots of worms that have just been sort of tread into the shag? We should have him do a bit where he comes in where we just give him some, like, shag carpet from an old-ass house somewhere and just see what's in it. Like,
I actually have a big extra hunk from when they carpeted my my house. I have a big hunk of carpet. We could mess it up, and he could clean it.
Like the Kirby guy used to do when he'd come to your house and he'd dump dirt on the floor. Because, you know, the thing is, like, you remember years ago, intern Kyle on this show from many, many generations back, you know, he lived in this huge house of dudes up in the West Hills. And it was a really nice house, but the house had not been lived in or remodeled since, like, 1975. And so it had this, like, thick 5-inch shag carpeting that I don't think had ever seen a vacuum cleaner. And I just wonder, like, how much pot resin, you know, like, how many fingernails are in there? You know, it's just, I always wanted to just get like, you know, the CSI Mythbusters, you know, that type of in there just to sort of clean it out and just see what's in that shag carpet.
By sheer coincidence, as you were saying that, someone on the text box said, can it clean dirty bong water stains?
Yes. Well, I would imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to speak for Michael on this score, but, you know, because the thing is, like, people say, well, I'm going to clean it myself. And you and I both know that's a lie, friend.
Yeah.
You're going to be cleaning nothing. And even if you try to clean it, and let me tell you this, you'll try to clean it the same way I do. You will go to Safeway and you'll rent one of those, like, steamer things for, like, $4. That's not going to work. It's going to accomplish nothing. That's just going to put a bunch of dirty water in a big tub that you have to clean out. So don't just spare yourself the trouble. They do stain removal, carpet repairs, upholstery, stone, marble, tile. Essentially anything that your feet are going to trot upon and dirty up, they'll clean for you. So pet damage, odor repair, just do yourself a favor. Give them a call. The Cleaning Solution, his name is Michael Beatty at 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. 3211, and please do tell him you heard about it on the Rick Emerson radio program. The Cleaning Solution, Michael Beatty, 533, I'm sorry, prefix 971-533-3211. He is one of the reasons that you, for the low, low price of 32 cents a day, are able to hear things like this Sarah Palin cut. So listener Jason sent this to me. This is Sarah Palin, who, God help me, I can't quit finding her hot. I mean, it doesn't matter how dumb she is.
God.
I can't, I mean, there's no, I cannot not find her just completely and utterly effable. There's no way. I don't think you could cover her in weevils, and I would still find her sexy. I just don't know why. Because usually it's like a hot chick. The longer they talk, if they're dumb, like the less attractive they become. And I know many guys aren't that way. Many guys don't care. You know, guys want them to shut up. You know, for whatever. You know, but they don't. That doesn't turn them off. For me, it's like I used to work. There was this radio station I worked at many, many years ago in Washington. And it was the same place where I worked in the bomb shelter. And there was this intern chick who worked there, and was just, like, scorchingly hot. But then she opened her mouth to say something one day. I was like, hey, Cindy, how are you? And she went, you know, and just a chain of inanities just rolled out, just a sort of cavalcade of idiocy. And I just went, oh, okay. And it was like hot be gone. I could no longer find her attractive. Or, like, the first time you heard Anna Nicole Smith speak, because I, for some reason, thought she was French, like way back when she was just a guest jeans model. Because she didn't, you know, she wasn't on TV or anything. And then the first time I heard Anna Nicole Smith open her mouth and talk was in a junket she was doing for the Naked Gun, Naked Gun 3 or 2 or whatever. And she opened her mouth and just that cornpone, Dukes of Hazzard thing came out. And I just...
Well, Jessica Simpson's the same way. She is just smoking hot to look at. And then she speaks and you go... Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, my God.
I don't want that in my home, in my bed, touching me in any way. I can't get past it. Sarah Palin, though, I don't know why. It doesn't have the same effect on me. Maybe it's because I kind of knew she was dumb, like, from jump. So this is Sarah Palin. Let me see. Where did I put this soundbite? So this so listener Jason sent this to us, and she is speaking here. She's talking on the Sean Hannity program. And I mean, right there, you got to figure, I mean, she's in sort of, I mean, she has a receptive audience. And you got to wonder, though, if in the back of his head when she says this, he's just going, God, we were going to get creamed in 2012. So he is talking to her about, I guess there's some sort of resolution that, like, the NAACP is trying to get passed where they're going to condemn the Tea Party folks as being racists. And so everybody in turn is then seizing on the NAACP, who I guess had some event. I'm reconstructing this from memory, so I don't know. But the NAACP wants the Tea Party condemned as racist, and the Tea Party wants the NAACP condemned as racist because I guess some member of theirs said the word cracker at some point in public. And I don't give an F. I don't. It's all worth it to get to this right here. I give you our possible next president.
Wife, you know, the first lady spoke at NAACP so recently. They have power in their words. They could refute what it is that this group is saying, and they could set the record straight. And they
let's hear that one more time.
You know, the first lady spoke at NAACP so recently. They have power in their words. They could refute what it is that this group is saying, and they could set the record straight. And they could correct what this false accusation is that the Tea Party American that moved. Movement is racist.
There I like the like agree. Think she could. They could refute it. Yeah.
Let's see if I can zoom in on it.
There
we go. Let's just isolate just that moment, Don, so we can hear it over and over again.
What it is.
All right. Let's.
That didn't really.
I'm about to.
What it is that this group.
Let me back up here, just so I can isolate.
Group is sane, and they could set the record straight, and they could correct. And the president and his wife, you know, the first lady.
She says they spoke at NAACP like it's a Red Robin, you know, like it's a city, like it's Des Moines or something. Let's see.
They spoke NAACP. They the power.
Okay, this is making me crazy.
All right, just
they could refute.
There we go. That's what I'm talking about. That's the money line right there. So anyway, so she says this, and then of course, idiot Sean Hannity, who just it's not like I even have any problem with him. It's just that he's so unbelievably dull. That's the other thing about Sean Hannity is he's just a dullard. There's nothing interesting about that guy at all in any way. But you're right that he nods his head and he just goes, no, that's right. No, that makes a lot of
sense. You know, the first lady spoke at NAACP so recently. They have power in their words. They could refute what it is that this group is saying, and they could set the record straight.
And then in her on her blog, when somebody pointed out that refute wasn't actually like, you know, a word, I think she actually defended it, saying that she was coining a word, wait for it, as Shakespeare did in his day.
Yeah.
Do you have the actual blog post there?
It was on Twitter, and she wrote, refute, misunderestimate, wee-weed up. English is a living language. Shakespeare liked to coin new words, too. Got to celebrate it.
Yes, you have
wife,
to.
You know, the first lady spoke at NAACP so recently. They have power in their words. They could refute what it is.
The best part is how she nails that second syllable. She punches it because you can tell in her brain there is no red underlining happening. Saying not a word, not a caution, not a word. Let's just one
wife, you know, the first lady spoke at NAACP so recently. They have power in their words. They could refute what it is.
They could, couldn't they? She says some inane things before that, too. They're sort of pointless, except that there is this one moment where she's going on, and it's where she's stringing words together in what sound like a sentence, but then you realize she said sort of nothing at the end of it. Let's see if I have...
Governor, you have been one of the strongest, most outspoken members in support of the Tea Party movement.
A model for women everywhere, by the way.
I've met a lot of members, organizers of the Tea Party movement. I've been at some of their rallies. I've witnessed it up close and personal. Members of the NAACP are going to vote tomorrow on a resolution that condemns what the group calls, the NAACP, explicitly racist behavior by supporters of the Tea Party movement.
Now, what do you suppose her response to this is before she gets to the refuting business?
Wow. A normal person, even if they were a Republican, a normal person say, might just say, oh, I don't believe that that's true. Or, oh, my Tea Party people aren't racist. But as given what Republicans were wont to do, I think, yes, she probably turns around and says, the NCAA, the NAACP are racist.
No, she does the long rambling thing where she
says nothing.
She says nothing, and then she refers to them as Americans, I believe, twice here. So
I wanted to get your reaction to that.
Yeah, this is some typical divisive politics.
Divisive.
That is so absolutely.
Shakespeare said divisive, you know.
Divisive.
Absolutely unnecessary, especially at this time of turmoil within our country. Turmoil when you consider the state of the economy and so many other challenges that we're
and the whatnot
facing. This is just so unnecessary. Nope, the Tea Party movement is a beautiful movement full of diverse people, diverse.
And rainbows and bunnies.
Diverse people, yes.
I think she means diverse.
Backgrounds, folks of all walks of life who, for the most
part,
happen to oppose President Obama's policies, not the color of his skin. They don't care that he's half white or half black.
Oh, God.
I love this country. I love the 2012 election. It hasn't even happened yet. It just can't come fast enough. I mean, the primary season cannot possibly get here soon enough for me.
I do have something over here. Apparently, this is not the first time she's used the word refudiate, so I've got some audio.
Oh, excellent. That's wonderful. All right.
They have power in their words. They could refudiate what it is that this group is saying, and they could set
the
record
straight.
And they could correct what this false accusation is, that the Tea Party American, that movement, is racist.
Oh, and the First Lady spoke there
today. Yeah,
so that was the same thing. Yeah.
So they're just saying that her using it in Twitter is actually...
No, because that's where she
first time she did it.
That's where she went to defend it, and you know, but I love that she just finds a way to sort of. This is the great thing about Sarah Palin. She's just such a street fighter, where she goes right to the
policies, not the color of his skin. They don't care that he's half white or half black.
There's just no. It's like right to the scorched earth approach with her.
Yeah, apparently this soundbite that we're playing here. This actually is a previous time she used refudiate. This all came up today because she had posted something on Twitter using the word again, which where she had written on Twitter, Ground Zero Musk supporters, doesn't it stab you in the heart as it does ours throughout the heartland? Peaceful Muslims, please refudiate.
Wife, you know, the First Lady spoke at NAACP so recently. They have power in their words. They could refudiate what it is that this group is saying. Yeah.
I so hope that becomes an accepted part of the English lexicon. Just within like 2 weeks. And you know, you absolutely know, just as sure as you know your middle name, that within the next probably 48 hours of the news cycle, somebody
on Fox News,
some fat bastard Republican, will be giving a press conference or something, and he'll use the word with just a little bit of a wink and a nod, so you know that he knows that, you know, he's making it up, but that he's standing behind her and not letting the liberal elite tell him how to use the language.
God.
It's, this country is just is awesome beyond words. I mean, it really is. It's just, it's fantastic. And she is, and see, here's the thing. This is, like, no one knows all the things that I know, Dawn. No one sees the bigger picture here, which is just that like Sarah Palin in the grand scheme of things like matters so little. And people will just get themselves in such a twist over her. And, you know, she just matters dick, like to the grand scheme of how things unfold in this republic of ours. It doesn't matter at all. They just don't embrace her for the entertainment value that she provides. And I also have to say that they don't recognize how savvy she is because, and I don't think this is her handlers. I get the feeling you can't really handle Sarah Palin. I get the feeling there's not a lot of filter between her and you know, and that Twitter account. I think that's what the McCain people found out is that they tried to, Sarah, maybe you should not, no, don't, it's not a word, Sarah, you know, and she would just go out and do it anyway. She's doing a really smart thing, though, in that she is just turning right into the skid and using it again and refusing to back down, which is exactly why people like her. And people can smirk at that all they want, but that is exactly the sort of thing that solidifies her support. And it is a guitarist friend of mine once said, he said, if you're ever playing guitar live, and he's like, if you make a mistake, it doesn't matter. You just make it twice more in rapid succession, and then it becomes a thing you obviously intended to do. It becomes your personal style. He's like, if you play the wrong note, He's like, play it wrong the next two times as well, and people will think it is how you meant. It's how you interpret that song. That is what she's doing. So she's just going to say it to word and say it to word. And you know what? Goddamned if it won't become a word within like 5 years. It'll be like when Fred Durst was talking about the when he said agreeance. Well, I'm in agreeance with, now agreeance is just a thing people say. So there you go. One more time for the It's For
Why? If you know, the first lady spoke at NAACP so recently. They have power in their words. They could refute what it is that this group is saying.
It's glorious. It really is a great time to be alive, Don Taylor. I get the feeling you're not sharing in my joy.
I don't really feel the joy.
What? Do you not? I mean...
I just feel weary and disgusted a great deal of the time by these people.
Do you not enjoy politics as sort of an entertainment, as a spectator sport?
Not really, no.
How is that possible? Who are you? How did you get in the studio? All right, well, whatever. All right, fine.
We can't be alike in every way, Rick.
I'm just saying it's you don't follow traditional sports.
No.
You don't take part in most traditional competitive American activities. This could be the thing you follow. This could be the league for which you keep stats and scores.
Maybe I'm just not an especially competitive person. Maybe I'm just not interested in competition overall.
Okay, let me put it this way. You like drama. You like stories that unfold with compelling characters and unforeseen twists, and where the outcome is always uncertain. Whoever would have thought that we would be considering this woman for president?
Why, if you know, the first lady spoke at NAACP.
I mean,
I don't find that delightful. I find that actually just makes me feel a little queasy.
You got to get past that. All right, let's. I know we have a watch or two to do before we get to the top five here.
Okay. Well, we do have a Hick Watch.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Without further ado, we present your Hick Watch for a Tuesday right here in the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Spitting, slobbering on around the house. That Copenhagen makes me feel so good.
Here is your Hick Watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
A bobcat became trapped in a chicken coop on a Northwest Portland family's property early today.
He's a bobcat in a chicken scoop. Chicken, I was trying to do sitcom. Chicken scoop. It's one crazy sitcom was how that whole joke was going to end. That's a fail. Sorry.
Dana Jeswinski and her husband heard a commotion and chickens rustling in the coop at about midnight at their home on West Road. When they went out to investigate, Jeswinski's husband found the bobcat inside the coop. Jeswinski said her husband shut the door to the coop and they called the police. She said the bobcat, quote, was bouncing around like a ping pong ball after the coop door closed. Police officers responded, were not able to safely remove the bobcat from the chicken coop. So they called Department of Fish and Wildlife and went back to bed. When the couple woke up, however, they found the bobcat had knocked down a window of the chicken coop, taken one of the chickens, and escaped.
And so what far-flung part of our fine state hosted this story? Where did this take place? Surely miles and miles, probably thousands of miles from where I'm sitting
right
here.
No, that would be here in the city of Portland, Oregon.
Okay, there you go. What part of Portland? Was it some remote part that was isolated from the rest of our fair metropolis?
No, right in the city limits. I'm not sure where West Road is exactly, but...
I bet it's not really a road, though. I bet the West is the only part of that sentence that's true. I'm imagining.
Now I'm curious. I'm going to have pull up Google Maps.
I'm thinking it's a bit of a dirt path, probably, with many children who are poorly diapered.
Yeah, but you know something, though? You're driving through Southeast Portland, and you like get three blocks off a main drag, and suddenly you're on one of these gravel, pitted roads that haven't been, like, these people, like, aren't on the sewer system. Portland's just like that.
It's off the gridville. And where they've actually taken, though, the time and found the money to buy a sign that says unfinished road. As if, like, you're there. You're here to put in the sign. Maybe just a little asphalt. You know, or just like a tarp, maybe, to hold down the dust. Jesus.
West Road is in Northwest.
You were actually the one who referred to certain parts of the East Side as being where, when you take one wrong turn, suddenly you just see a bunch of children running around licking wooden spoons. Which is completely true, by the way. Yes. I mean, that's absolutely true.
I forgot I said that, yes.
Can I just tell you this?
Dirty children in their underpants licking wooden spoons.
My mom was in town over the weekend, and, you know, it's one of those things where we always offer her, and you're like, well, you know, we'll remake the bed. You can use it. And she's like, no, I'll sleep on the couch. And, you know, and then I protest, and she says, no, I don't want to be a bother, and whatever. So she sleeps on the couch in the living room. Not because I'm a bad son, but just because that's what she does. So she's sleeping on the couch in the living room, which is not too far from the street. And so we don't have time to tell the whole background to this, but there's a homeless guy who, for reasons that I don't even want to uncork now because it's going to become a whole separate show. There's a homeless guy who's been dropping by our house a whole lot, wanting to talk to my wife. And we'll have to talk about it tomorrow.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
And so he had made an appearance earlier that evening while my mom was around, and I'd shoot him away. But my mom was like, who's that? I'm like, it's this guy. Don't ask. Whatever. So the next morning, my mom says this thing. This is Southeast Portland, like, in a nutshell. The next morning, my mom, who, again, had been sleeping on the couch in the living room, says, you know, it was weird that homeless guy came by last night. I said, yeah, it's a whole thing and, you know, whatever. And she said, yeah, you know, all night long, you know, when I was trying to sleep, you know, every time a shopping cart would go by the house, I would think it was him. And Laura pointed out that really is emblematic of our neighborhood, that the phrase, every time a shopping cart went by, which apparently was about every 12 minutes. It was just constant throughout the night. A series of shopping. Laura and I went out. We went out to take the dogs out because we have a little fenced-in area. To take the dogs out just for a quick outdoor break before they were going to bed for the night. I don't know, maybe a week and a half ago. And, you know, we hear the telltale Marley chain rattling sound of a shopping cart, you know, kind of motivating on down our street. And we look, and I swear to Christ, a guy had a full, intact sofa perched on top of his shopping cart that he was sort of down the street. Like, it wasn't the remnants of a sofa or the cushions or the skeleton. It was a full, giant, what looked to
be... How else are you going to move a sofa by yourself?
And it was like...
Get a shopping cart.
It was in perfect condition. And it was, I mean, it's so much larger than the shopping cart that was carrying it. I mean, and he was just kind of pushing the whole... It was like one of those trailers, those trucks with like a mobile home in the back of it on the highway. And we just sort of sat, and it was like a cutaway scene from Arrested Development where we just sat and watched for like an hour as he just moved this couch past our house on a shopping cart. I just live in hell. I live in some horrible post-apocalyptic Frank Darabont world. It's just...
Yet you do not have bobcats in your chicken coop.
No. And this couple with the bobcat in their chicken coop, which sounds like it's like code for something, did they say they had a ruckus or a commotion?
A commotion.
It's like I picture Yosemite Sam. We have some sort of rack-a-fratsin thing happening out back.
A fracas.
They how sad or great, I guess, for them that they actually had apparently on speed dial the number for the wildlife, the Bureau of Wildlife and Animal Management or whatever the hell it is.
Well, the couple did estimate that the bobcat was about 3 feet tall and roughly three times larger than their domestic cats, but not large enough to be a cougar.
All right. I don't even know what a bobcat is. Is that like a...
They look like really big cats, and they've got the kind of the whiskers that come out from their jawline.
Yeah,
and the pointy ears with the fur coming out of their ears.
So that's not like just a regular cat that's gone feral or something.
No, they're a different wild animal. Cat. Yes, okay. They are a wild cat.
Like it's like a lynx or something almost.
Yes,
then.
Okay. Kind of like a lynx.
All right, excellent. There you go. There's your hit, which we should know was apparently from Northwest Portland.
Yes, it was Northwest Portland.
How is that possible?
Up kind of by Sunset Highway.
Oh, well, that's how. All right, there you go. There's your Hick Watch for...
Copenhagen makes me feel so good. Copenhagen, the way I know it should. Well, I put a little chew in my mouth, go spitting, slobbering all around the house. That Copenhagen makes me feel so good. How about you?
Fantastic. All right. Let's do one more here, and then I have the Pop Culture
the
Authority.
Longest show ever.
Which I, here's the thing. I can do the Pop Culture Authority today, or I can do it tomorrow. We got the top five here.
Yeah.
I don't know. You make
the
call.
Why don't we save the Pop Culture Authority for tomorrow?
All right, we'll do it tomorrow. So tomorrow's Pop Culture, so I don't mean to be a jerk about it. We'll put it off. Tomorrow's Pop Culture Authority is going to be from whence the name Cujo derives. So, and I keep doing that thing where I make it redundant with the, anyway. Are we doing the top five here? Or let's do one more, and then we'll roll the top five. Okay. All right, here's Dawn Taylor, ladies and gentlemen.
HIV/AIDS infections have reached epidemic levels in major American inner cities. That's the conclusion of a new first-of-its-kind analysis by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Kevin Fenton is the director of the CDC's National Center for HIV/AIDS.
What is the count
HIV
here?
HIV inner city.
2.1% of heterosexuals living in high poverty areas of major U.S. cities are infected with HIV. This is substantially higher than the prevalence that we see across the entire United States.
Okay, you know what that guy sounds like? That guy sounds like Andy the homeschool kid if he was affecting a British accent for some sort of a production at his college.
Oh, my God, you're right.
That is exactly. See, am I not correct about
yes.
that?
Yes.
Are we not men? No, we are Devo.
And he's Andy the homeschool man.
I know. That's why I don't come. Somebody was flipping me some crap on Facebook about the Andy's called in. You haven't identified him as Andy the homeschool kid. Have you shunned his nickname on the new show? And I just said that he was probably reaching a point in his life where he no longer wanted to be identified as Andy the homeschool kid. But Andy the homeschool man is sort of funny. It's sort of like being Popeye the Sailor Man, but not quite as great. But this guy sounds, you're right, exactly like Andy if he were putting on a sort of poncy accent for like
it's a Andy in a top hat with a monocle.
Yeah, like they were doing, like they were going to be doing a Noel Coward production of some kind.
2.1% of heterosexuals living in high poverty areas.
Yeah, that's exactly what that is. All right. Do we have more sound from this?
I think so, but what the copy I have here now just says, Fenton says 2.1% of heterosexuals in poor urban areas have the potentially deadly virus.
Is this...
And it's supposed to say 2%.
Is so. This... Oh, let's see. Where did that 2% sounder go? And...
So I think we're a little repetitive with this story here.
Yeah, I'm not even... I have that. I just don't know where it does.
I guess at this point...
No?
If we look at those women who use the gel...
No.
Just play that again.
I don't even think...
That applies to everything.
I'm not even sure that we've...
With this announcement, it looks...
I'm not even sure that we've done that one this hour, actually. The...
If we look at those women who use the gel most consistently, in those women... We see a 54%.
That's actually an entirely different cut.
I guess at this point, we are only hopeful that the regulators will give us some clarity about their expectations, and then we can plan on that basis.
All right. So the there's no time to really give you the background on this. I'll say this. When today's show ends and we go to the live stream, and we do this every day, by the way. So the live stream, there's going to be a little musical interlude of like 5 minutes or so. We'll do like a... we'll do like a Ramon song or something. Then we'll go to Legion of News, the encore of Legion of News for today. And then we'll go to the encore of this show. So if you miss these shows, we encore them right afterward after a little music break. We have this soundbite in Legion of News today, which is this guy talking about the spread of AIDS, like somewhere. And he says this.
I guess at this point, we are only hopeful that the regulators will give us some clarity about their expectations, and then we can plan on that basis.
So we've decided that this is going to be our catch-all soundbite for everything. So, like, here's the thing. Anybody who misses today's show, you've got one up on them, because we're not ever going to explain it again. So just if you're listening today, realize that this guy, whose real name I have now forgotten, it was like Yasir Hamanamam.
Dr. Kareem,
something.
I believe.
Dr. Kareem. He will now become our because this soundbite means nothing, and it's about everything and nothing. This will be our de facto, our like default go-to soundbite for all stories whenever we need sound on something. So we'll say, what is the Federation going to do about the presence of the bobcat?
I guess at this point, we are only hopeful that the regulators will give us some clarity about their expectations, and then we can plan on that basis.
Meanwhile, Ms. Lohan's lawyer said that they were not exactly sure when the special accommodations would take place, but that...
I guess at this point, we are only hopeful that the regulators will give us some clarity about their expectations, and then we can plan on that basis.
And following the tasing of the man's genitals, they said that new governance laws will be put in place mandating the use of additional training for tasing devices. The representative followed up by saying,
I guess at this point, we are only hopeful that the regulators will give us some clarity about their expectations, and then we can plan on that basis.
Asked how long Ms. Taylor was expected to remain in the morphine-induced coma, her doctor said,
I guess at this point, we are only hopeful that so the regulators will give us some clarity about their expectations, and then we can plan on that basis.
It's awesome. So there you go. That guy has now become every soundbite we need for everything.
He is the expert on everything.
All right, fantastic. All right, here's your top five for Tuesday right here on the Rick Emerson Radio
five,
program.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire.
Counting is wonderful, counting is marvelous, counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is ecstasy, I love to count, don't you?
How long do you think today's show's been going, Don?
How long?
Yeah.
Well, I know
you're cheating, you're looking at the clock.
Well, I've seen the clock. I've been keeping an eye on the clock. We're a good half hour or so over.
We really can't be stopped. We're a juggernaut of entertainment. All right. Here's your top five. These are the top five songs about computers. And by the way, I am really impressed that you did this because, you know, not that I expect anything less, but I was having difficulty coming up with songs about computers. But I think that's maybe because the music that I typically listen to, I mean, again, you leave off your Colton and your Yankovic and whatever, doesn't really have a lot of. It's not like Slayer is writing a lot of songs about, you know, ENIAC or something. There's just not, you know, there's no. It's got switches, you flip. I really want to do that now.
Please write that song now.
I have Slayer singing a song about the Altair. It came in the mail. I had to solder it together. Okay, but you came up with five, you know, apparently with no trouble. So here we go. These are the top five songs about computers as put together by Don Taylor.
Honorable mention, Automation, and Alan Sherman.
Automation. Alan Sherman. Good. Before we even play this, good for the win. I never looked at the list. I handed it to you without even looking at it. I racked them up, but I didn't see what they were. Stop. Okay. I believe, inexplicably enough, in the decade plus that we've been doing this dumb show in Portland, this, I think, is the first time we have played Alan Sherman.
Really?
We've played Stan Freberg. We've played Spike Jones. We've played Weird Al Yankovic, obviously, and Mojo Nixon.
No Alan Sherman.
Ogden Edsel. I mean, I've played the Barnes and Barnes. No Alan Sherman. Alan Sherman was the Weird Al Yankovic, the original Weird Al Yankovic. Much as I love Stan Freberg, Alan Sherman was the guy who created or who popularized in America the parody of the modern pop song.
Yeah.
Well done.
Well, thank you.
I have a whole new respect for you. All right.
So this is Automation by Alan Sherman.
It was automation. I know.
I have this on vinyl.
That was what was making the factory go. It was IBM. It was UNIVAC. It was all those gears going clickety-clack.
Wow.
Dear.
I'm a failure for not thinking of this.
I thought automation was keen till you were replaced by a 10-ton machine. It was that computer that tore us apart. Dear. Automation broke my heart.
Wow. I gotta go home and listen to my Alan Sherman records.
You've never listened to enough Alan Sherman.
Standing next to me, dear, where you used to be.
Here's the thing about Alan Sherman records is that
doesn't have your shape.
I think this is from the My Son the Nut album.
Yes, yes it is.
Which, it sounds like the whole thing was almost recorded in front of a live audience.
It was.
So, I guess my question is, so was he popularized like on radio or something, and then he would tour, and they would record the tour and put it out as an album?
I think he performed live, and then he did vinyl, you know, because he was a comedy act, basically. So he would go to nightclubs and do his act at nightclubs.
Wow.
And then he became popular through vinyl recordings of his nightclub act.
I could listen to Alan Sherman records all day now. All right, well done. Yeah, if you guys, anybody who is a fan of Weird Al Yankovic, you are listening to the guy right there. He de facto created the entire genre of parodying pop songs.
Yeah, most people are familiar with Hello Mudda, Hello Fada.
Right.
Don't necessarily know Alan Sherman or the rest of his body of work.
But they've never heard Sarah Jackman. All right. Excellent. Well, I don't even know how we can surpass that, but okay, go ahead.
It should have been higher up on the list, I guess, looking back. Number five is Kraftwerk Pocket Calculator.
Yeah, this is why you were the right person to do this list. I can count on zero fingers the number of Kraftwerk records that I own.
Well, this is from their album Computer World, and all of the songs were about computers. It was 1981, believe it or not. And it, Kraftwerk, yeah, it's not like, you know, the most listenable music looking back on it now, but it was really influential on disco, on like mid to late 80s David Bowie.
Yeah.
David Bowie was a huge Kraftwerk fan.
I'm the operator with my pocket calculator. Well, and a lot of Kraftwerk ended up having a big influence in hip hop as well, because a lot of the sort of more electro forms of hip hop, like Afrika Bambaataa was the guy everybody, you know, they point to him, but a lot of so-called like electro clash and all of that stuff is drawn right from this. And not to mention that there would have been like no, I don't know, pick one, like no information society, you know, 15 years later, 10 years later, if it hadn't been for these guys. And composing. One of the information society guys lives in Portland, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. I believe it is. I believe it's Paul Robb who lives here.
And there's more of the same.
I'm going to go back to just dragging the scrub bar over the Sarah Palin audio again. All right. I mean, I can get the appeal of this. I'll put it this way. I can totally see why Gustav from KNRK listened to this a lot when he was growing up, as he clearly did.
And it was really fascinating and really new at the time.
Yeah.
You know, it. So.
Yeah, I'm just waiting on you.
Okay. Number four, Jim Noir, a computer song. I don't know if you're familiar with Jim Noir.
No.
He's a British fellow who, Jim Noir is a pseudonym, and he does humorous songs.
This song, and in fact, this list is one of the reasons why Dr. Demento has had a career for like 90 years. Because, you know, his show is, the first hour is like freeform and the second hour is a theme. And he'll do, you know, the second hour is all songs about computers or all songs about food or all songs about animals. And, you know, he just has a library of this of like 1,000 songs deep. Yeah, you know, I've never heard this. I like hearing stuff that I haven't heard before. Jim Noir. It's a cool name. These are the top five songs about computers as compiled by Don Taylor.
Number three, Brad Paisley, Online.
Brad Paisley. Okay. I'm going to be honest. Were you familiar with the song before you started
looking? Yes, I was.
Okay.
I don't listen to much country, but every once in a while there's something that really appeals to me.
I don't mind Brad Paisley, actually. He's...
I work down at the pizza pit, and I drive an old Hyundai. I still live with my mom and dad. I'm 5'3" and overweight. I'm a sci-fi fanatic, mild asthmatic, never been to second base. Check out my space. It's all online. I'm out in Hollywood. I'm 6'5" and I look damn good. I drive a Maserati. I'm a black belt in karate. And I love a good glass of wine. It turns girls on that I'm mysterious. I tell them I don't want nothing serious. Cause even on a slow day, I can have a three-way chat with two.
All right, Here, this is pretty great. I wonder if he wrote this.
Probably not.
You know, it used to be, you know, we were sort of a bell curve where country guys never wrote their own stuff, and then they went through a phase where they did, and then they went through a phase again where it was a lot of professional songwriters. I'm gonna look this up right now because I know that Paisley has written a lot of his own stuff, and I wonder if he wrote this. And I further wonder, like, whenever I hear a country guy doing a song like this, then you wonder, like, okay, well, who is this for? Is it for his audience, or is it because he really is just some like closet nerd? You know, but
there've got to be at this point in society, there have to be country western nerds.
Yeah,
well. I mean, everybody, you know, 3/4 of Americans are online apparently now, according to statistics. So,
all right, let's see here. Looking for the song online. Do you know what album this comes from by chance?
No, not off the top of my head.
All right, so I have to.
Fifth Gear, I think.
Oh, here we go.
I'm
going to look it up right here. I was flicking through his Wikipedia entry, and I saw the words star and Trek next to each other. So he did. He wrote this with his collaborator. So he did co-write this, which I'm guessing it means probably the lyrics. Okay, listen to this. In the fall of 2009, it was announced to Variety that Brad Paisley would enter the world of scripted television as an executive producer of a new hour-long drama series for the CW called Nashville. The creator of the series, blah, 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 we'll correct. The executive producer is Zachary Quinto, who is the producer of Heroes. And it says also the producer of Star Trek, so I'm guessing that must be like,
yeah,
you know, whatever, like ones. Enterprise or some crap. Yeah. So he at least has some tangential relationship there. And as you said, I mean, it's like, country is not a place where I think even now, it's like if you're gay, you don't want to come out and be like, I'm a gay country singer. So you probably don't want to come out and go, I know pie to 70 places. But the fact that he mentions a three-way in this song is what indicates to me that he probably wrote this song, in other words, for himself. This is a song that he just wrote because he wanted to write it, because that's never going to get played on country radio. That's never going to, country radio is not going to play a single that says three-way. So that's an album cut, which means it's something he probably legitimately liked. So that was my suspicion that he might have written this. Well done, Brad Paisley. Good for you. All right, here's Don Taylor. Top 5 songs about computers.
Number 2, Bad Religion, I Love My Computer. I love Bad Religion so much.
I love my computer, you make me feel all right. Every waking hour and every lonely.
Has this been the nerdiest program we've ever done?
I think so.
We started with a War Games thing. I played this montage of computer spots. We talked to the Apple or the Avatron Apple guy for like an hour. Now we're doing this. I've never been quite so obvious. All I need to do is click on you, and we'll be turning on the soul's way. And we'll never. I've never heard this song. That's a great song.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sort of a moderate Bad Religion fan, but this is really good.
I love my computer. You're always in the mood. I get so turned on when I turn on you. I love my computer. You never ask for more. You can be a princess or you can be my whore. And it's never been quite so easy. I've never been quite so
excellent.
Thanks.
It's a fantastic top 5. I'm impressed. All right. Top 5 songs about the computer. And we are now at number 1, I believe.
Number 1, Black Sabbath, Computer God.
See, that's... I'm... A long sort of...
Yeah, it doesn't really click in until 27.
Did you actually time the intro length?
Yes, I even wrote it down. It's a put start at 27, but you aren't reading the list ahead of time. So
no, because I didn't. I wanted to avert my eyes. How long did it take you to put together this whole list?
About an hour.
Waiting for that revolution.
like just a soundtrack to going to the store for more Cheetos. See, now I'm doing that thing where I'm just sitting here and rocking.
Yes. We're both sitting here, our heads bobbing back and forth.
Excellent. Well done. All right. That's fantastic. Well, now I got to come up with something good for tomorrow. We really set the bar, like, unacceptably high, I think. Don't forget, tomorrow our guests will include Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. She will join us in the studio. Maybe she can find some place to put this refrigerator that seems to be dumb. You know, because there was like this day when the studio looked really great and like professional, and that day has long passed because there's a refrigerator that's like the size of my house in the back though. So
yeah, it you look over in that corner and it's like we're in a diner.
Yeah, it's
it should be full of like submarine sandwiches or pies or something.
We should totally do that, like, for no reason. We should just get a bunch of, like, mock pies and put them in there. And just have it rotating. Just start turning all day long. Excellent. All right. Well, I think we're done. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday. I'm sorry. From the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk is Don Taylor. Advanced technology and magic provided by Thomas Gill. Our executive producer is Bruce Agler. Chief of staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. We want to thank our guest, Dave Howell from Avatron Software. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. We also want to thank our fine sponsors, MugshotList.com and The Cleaning Solution. And your 32 cents well spent today and every day, my friend. My name is Rick Emerson. It is Tuesday, July 20th, 2010. That is The Frequency, Kenneth. Don't forget Legion of News from today. Encores next, following a musical interlude, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. Thanks for listening. Be safe. See y'all tomorrow. Watch out for snakes, won't you please?
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.